This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. William Moore on the 17th of December, year 2001, at approximately 3:40 Lubbock time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Moore is in Elkton, Maryland. Sir, why don't we begin with a brief discussion of your early life, and if you would, tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay, I'm not sure of that. I lived in the Philadelphia suburbs up until about age, about 23 or 24, and had a fairly normal childhood. I was from at 10 years of age, my father left, and my mother and father eventually got a divorce. I went to mostly Catholic schools, or a few years I was in public school system in the Philadelphia area. I was pretty lucky as a student. I was, I guess, blessed with maybe above normal intelligence. Had an easy time in school. Did well in school. Always had good grades and so forth. And that was my early years were just a typical kid. I had me and my brother. I had one brother, Bob. He's 3 years younger than me. He was born in 1946. And we were fairly close as brothers, just the two of us and my mother. So we were a fairly close family. Came from, I guess you would categorize me as, we came from a lower middle class, or maybe middle lower class family. We didn't have much money, but we got by. During my high school years is when I got interested in music. Got into shows and so forth in school, and I've always liked music, musicals, musicals. Started playing guitar at age 16. Played guitar all my life, and kicked around with a lot of different bands. Formed my first band in 1965, just before I went in the Army. I was 23 at the time, and played music in the tri-state area around Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware, just prior to going into the service in 1967.
Okay.
So that was my... when I was born until up until I was about 24.
Right. Was there anything in particular in school that you enjoyed as far as subjects?
Yes. I really enjoyed English, history, social studies. Mm-hmm. My weak subject was mathematics. I wasn't really interested in mathematics. I was more interested in geography of the world, history, and so forth.
Okay.
I studied the in high school what they call the academic studies, hoping to eventually go to college, but that didn't work out. Things came along, like getting married, and then the war.
Okay. When you graduated from high school, did you spend much time in school after that, before going in the Army?
Right after high school, I went to work as a trainee in the electronics field. Started out with a small outfit in Woodland, Pennsylvania, Columbia Research Laboratories, and they started training me, and I picked it up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
Worked there about 3-4 years. Got my training in electronics there.
Okay.
And during that time is when I also got married.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just recently married, and then I had had a son born 2 years after I was married.
Mm-hmm.
And then problems started with the marriage. The marriage eventually ended. And I was separated at the time that I got a draft notice. Well, I knew the draft notice was coming.
Yeah.
So I got like a pre-draft notice.
Okay.
And that was during the real big build-up for the Vietnam War in 66-67
mm-hmm.
period.
Mm-hmm.
So well, I wanted to pursue my electronics field, so I enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I had a good score on the test they give you when you go in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me in the electronics field.
Okay.
Radio carrier attendant, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Where we took the phone lines and multiplexed them onto radio shots and shot them on down the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's so then I was in the Army from August 67.
Mm-hmm.
Did well in that school down at the signal school at Fort. That was in Georgia. What was it? Fort Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I finished as one of the honor graduates in that course, and they asked me to stay over and be an instructor.
Hmm.
Because they had three shifts going at the time, 24-hour operation during this big buildup. And they had to get a lot of guys trained, and
mm-hmm.
they were short instructors.
Mm-hmm.
So they would ask the honor graduates and some of the guys that knew the subject and finished well to stay over and be instructors. So I said, sure, I'll do that. So I did that for a while. I did that for 9 months. And once we trained enough guys, they didn't need us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we had come down. There was four different what they called levies for Vietnam, and they kept kicking us off of that. We didn't have to go at first because they still needed us as instructors. But once we got enough students through the course and the manpower requirement was less, then they took 450 of us instructors on one levy and piped us off to Vietnam. So that's, I just sort of delayed
mm-hmm.
going over there by having this instructor course.
Right. Well, before you went into the Army, what did you know about Vietnam? What did you know about what the United States was doing over there?
Well, I knew that early in the war, I knew we had what they called advisors over there, which were, I found out later, mostly Special Forces guys, training the South Vietnamese and how to fight. You know, it was a civil war. From what I had heard in school and after school when I was working, from the age of 18 to 22 or 3, was that the main thing we were trying to do over there was have the South win and set up their form of government, and so that communism would not take over the whole country. So there was a theory at the time called the domino theory, which was a big phrase going around, and they were afraid, well, we were told, and from what I heard and what I read, that if Vietnam fell, it would be like a chain reaction, and a lot of the countries in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific Rim would fall to communism. So when it was time for me to go to defend that, I went for the country to stop the spread of communism, basically. That's why I went. And that was my motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the motivation of a lot of guys.
Yes, sir. Well, did you know many people, many men, say, from your neighborhood or guys that you came to know before joining the Army? They had gone to Vietnam and come back?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Okay.
Didn't know anybody that had been over there.
Okay.
Like I say, it was from 63 to, say, 65, there wasn't too many over there, too many of us over there.
Right.
And the big buildup started in late 65 through 67.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole bunch of young guys either were drafted or enlisted and, you know, went over and did their duty.
Yep.
Went over there with the intent to help the United States stop the spread of communism.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your introduction to military life with regard to basic training. What day did you leave, if you remember the day?
I left on August, I believe it was 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been the 12th.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember.
But you
it
went
was in August of 67.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I left Media, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
On a bus. Busloads of us went to the processing center in North Philadelphia, PA. They did some processing there, swore us in, and all the guys stepped forward. There were no conscientious objectors or anything. They took that one step forward. Swore our allegiance to the Constitution and to the President, and were formally inducted into the U.S. Army. From there, we got on a train and traveled to Fayetteville, North Carolina. And the only thing I remember about the train trip, we left late in the afternoon, it was all night long, and look out the window once in a while, and you'd see the backwaters of some town they'd stop at or go real slow through, you know, where train tracks were always on the wrong side of town. It wasn't a very nice trip down there. Got there early in the morning, and we were met by the drill instructors at the train station. And there was a lot of trains coming in every day. It's full of guys because basic training was really in full swing in August of 67. There was a big, big buildup in the military. And it was so many guys, they put us in the first week was a holding week. There wasn't even room to put us into a company yet to start our basic training. So for a week, we basically did details. Got yelled at a lot by the TIs and got our initiation into the military, into the basic training part of it. And they gave us the battery of tests, and they gave us our haircuts, and gave us our uniforms, our basic issue, and that was all during that first week. And I was to find out later on that the battery of tests they gave us were very important at that time in the military. That's where they would select, most of the time, where they would select what you would be doing for your next 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily I did well in most of the tests. I did well in the basic aptitude test. I did well in the electronics test, and I did well in the language test. In fact, later on in my military career, they wanted to send me to learn Russian, but I turned that down because I didn't want to end up, say, in Berlin, some embassy, being a Russian translator, you know, sitting at a desk all day. Anyway, I wanted to get into the electronics part.
Okay.
And then basic training was condensed. They knocked it down from 12 weeks to 8 weeks, and it was pretty hectic. It was 8 weeks of go, go, go. They had to get us through there and to make room for the guys coming in behind us. And it was at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, just outside of Fayetteville. Big post, very large post. It was the home of the 82nd Airborne. I think it still is. A lot of airborne troops there, and at that time, a lot of basic training. And I was put in, if I forget the name of the company, I don't know, it was ABC company, it was some basic training company, and they ran us through the 12-week course in 8 weeks. They condensed it down to get us through there quick. And we just learned the basics. We learned how to march, how to drill, how to shoot a rifle. We got to throw one live grenade. That was our live fire with grenades. I think we had a day or two, about a day and a half of instruction on grenades and what to do with them, and then they finally took us out on the line and put us in these sandbag, like little bunkers, about chest high, the sandbags. And you and your instructor, your drill sergeant, or his, one of the instructors, and they would hand you the grenade, and you would pull the pin just the way they showed you and throw this thing and duck down behind the sandbags. Rifle range was about, we spent parts of 2 weeks out there zeroing our weapons. The weapon of choice then was the M14 rifle. It was a very good weapon. It was pretty accurate. I remember it being heavy, as opposed to the M16, which I got later. I scored sharpshooter, which is like mid-range on a rifle. I had never fired a rifle in my life until basic training. And, of course, you learn how to take it apart, put it together in your sleep. And during the qualification, I shot well enough to get a sharpshooter qualification. Later on down the road in my military career, I qualified with the M16 and shot expert with it. It was a little easier to handle, and it was just as accurate and a lot lighter. So basic training was a lot of physical exercise, a lot of running. Everything was double time, go, go, go. Meals, well, three meals a day, but before each meal, you had to do the low crawl on the mats out in front of the mess hall. And I went through 8 weeks of basic training with skinned knees and elbows because I couldn't master the low crawl. Didn't do it right, so I had a sword on my knees and elbows the whole time through the 8 weeks. And then the next day, you know, every day crawling on them would just break them open again. But something you had to put up with. And you just put up with everything they threw at you just to get through it. So after the 8 weeks, we did have a graduation parade with all the companies that were graduating that week. And I didn't get to march in the parade because they made me an usher. I was an usher for the VIPs and the families that were coming down to see the guys graduate.
Okay.
And I didn't mind that. You know, I got to meet a lot of nice people, and it wasn't too bad. I saw my company march by, but I didn't march with them. But it didn't really bother me that much. We got our orders right after basic the next day. I would say 90% of our company, which was four platoons, each platoon was about 40 guys, about 90% of them immediately got orders for an infantry MOS 11B. A lot of the remaining 10 or 12% got orders for other MOSs. But right at that time, in October of 67, most of the guys going through basic at Fort Bragg anyway got 11B MOS. They went to infantry training.
Okay.
I got 31M, which is a real long term they call radio relay and carrier attendant, which was, like I say, multiplexing telephone circuits onto radio shots and shooting them line of sight 30 or 40 miles, and then at the other end, breaking them down back to telephone line. So that was basic.
Okay.
It was pretty hectic.
Well,
real quick.
Yeah. How did they enforce discipline among you and your fellow trainees?
Oh, it was, if one guy, to keep the teamwork up, I think that's why they did it. later on I realized it, to ensure that the teamwork would build up, and it's the if one guy messed up, the whole platoon paid for it, you know, the mass punishment. He'd have to do extra running, or now if somebody did something real serious, of course the UCMJ would come in, but you know, petty stuff like I don't know, turning left face when you're supposed to go right face, you know, we'd do extra push-ups the whole platoon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would leave it up to the squad leaders or the platoon leaders, the guys in basic, to get the guy aside and straighten him out,
mm-hmm.
you know, for minor offenses.
Yeah.
Anything serious, of course, the UCMJ took over.
Did that happen? Serious offenses?
No, we not in my platoon.
Okay.
Didn't see anything in basic serious. We had one guy go AWOL.
Yeah.
Never saw him again. I don't know what happened to him.
Okay.
He just got tired of it and left one night.
Okay.
But they pushed us through it. Or if he did come back, he got punished and then went into another basic company.
Yeah.
You know, had to do it all over. But
right.
I don't ever know what happened to him.
Any punishments imposed by trainees? You know, blanket parties, GI showers, that kind of stuff?
No, not my 8 weeks.
Okay.
No.
And how about, let's see, training specific for Vietnam? Was there any of that for you yet in basic?
Yeah, that was a real short course. I forget how many days it was. It wasn't more than three. I think it was 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us somewhere on post there. And no, this was at Fort Gordon. They did that. That's right. After I, after I reported for schooling, MOS training. And no, I take that back. It was after I came down on that levee. I was an instructor. Once they knew I was going to Vietnam, they sent us to this short course on what to expect over there. That was at Fort Gordon in about late summer, early fall of 68,
mm-hmm.
before I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been in the fall because I went to Vietnam in October.
Okay.
And it wasn't anything special. Of course, they had sergeants that had been over there gave the courses.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was an officer there too, but he didn't do much. And all I can remember was mostly talking to us.
Okay.
We'd sit in the bleachers and they'd tell us about Vietnam. They mm-hmm. didn't have, at that time, the simulated villages and the walkthrough and stuff that they had later on down the road.
Mm-hmm.
It was just mostly oral teaching
mm-hmm.
and war stories of what these sergeants had experienced over there.
Okay, that was my next question. Did many of your drill instructors in basic have Vietnam experience?
In basic, I don't remember any of them. We had three drill sergeants for just our platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of them, I don't remember any of them talking about Vietnam. They'd been drill instructors for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're like third, fourth year of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew their business. They knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they didn't talk about Vietnam that much.
Okay. And let's see. Did you have anybody drop out of basic?
Yes.
Besides the one AWOL?
Well, besides the guy that went AWOL,
right.
We had one kid that He didn't drop out. He got set back.
Okay.
And it seemed like every company, every platoon had one. The big fat guy. The big heavy guy.
Okay.
He just couldn't keep up with us. And they kind of rode him pretty hard. They did everything they could for him and
mm-hmm.
the squad leaders and all, but he just couldn't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
So he got washed back, had to start over.
Okay.
But I remember a kid trying hard. But
mm-hmm.
he just couldn't do it. He couldn't run, you know, couldn't run, couldn't keep up.
Mm-hmm.
But they had special education for those fellows.
Mm-hmm.
They would have special training and send them back a couple weeks, and they'd go with another another platoon,
mm-hmm.
with a company.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he eventually made it through.
Okay.
It seems like the guys, the little guys like me, we gained weight during basic, and the big guys usually lost a lot of weight. Because it was pretty rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Besides low crawl, you're always doing push-ups. You're always doing the horizontal bars and running. Everything was double time
mm-hmm.
or running. In fact, the PT test at that time consisted of a one-mile run, how many horizontal bars you can do in 1 minute, the low crawl, what's a thing called the run, dodge, and jump, where you run around these barriers and jump over ditches. And the fifth event was push-ups.
Okay.
So, and then beside that, you had your what they called the daily dozen. You'd have calisthenics every morning, do
mm-hmm.
these 12 exercises,
mm-hmm.
Jumping jacks and squat thrusts. And when we finally got our M14s, you just have to do these squat thrusts with holding the rifle over your head. And it toughened you up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of exercise.
Yeah.
They wanted to build you up, you know, build up your endurance, build up your muscle strength. The food was high protein, a lot of carbohydrates. So, like I say, the little guys like me usually put on weight. The bigger guys, they worked them so hard they lost weight.
Mm-hmm.
So basic was just what they call it, basic training. We learned just the basics and how to be a soldier.
Right. Well, what was it like going from your basic at Fort Bragg to your military occupational specialty training there at Fort
Gordon? It was difference of night and day.
Yeah.
It was still pretty hectic. I mean, it was still, everything was done in groups. You marched to school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got up and you had your breakfast, and then they marched you to school, to class. And then it would be 4 hours of class in the morning, if you had the day shift. And then they'd march you back for lunch, and then march you back to school, and then 4 hours in the afternoon. And I enjoyed it. It was 12 weeks. You learned all the radio equipment, all the telephone equipment, and all the multiplexing equipment. And, of course, the 1 week of the 12 was map reading and compass and how to shoot azimuths, because you had to set up antennas. You had to know about maps and azimuths and so forth, and it was pretty interesting. We were operators. We weren't the MOS that actually fixed the stuff. We were just operators, so we only did operator maintenance and operated the equipment. Later on, I got into tinkering with the stuff and learned on my own how to fix, you know, if radio broke or multiplexer broke, I could fix them. But they frowned on the operators getting into the equipment, but a lot of the guys didn't know what they were doing. But I had already had some electronic training, so they didn't mind me touching the stuff too much. And it was, like I say, 12 weeks. I did well in the course. I was one of the five top graduates. I think I had a 95 average for all the testing and all. And that was a big part of them asking me to stay over to be an instructor. So we graduated from that, and they held me over as what they call permanent party at Fort Gordon. And before I could go out and start giving classes, we had to go to a condensed two-week course of how to be an Army instructor. It was called IMD, Instructor Methods Division. And went to two more weeks of classes on how to give classes. And that was fun. Because I'd already had experience in standing up and being in front of people, and I felt at ease. I wasn't nervous or anything, because
yeah.
I had played music out in clubs and stuff, and I was always entertaining people and talking with people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something different, and you had to learn the Army way of giving a class, which is you teach to the lowest level of the class, and there's a lot of do's and don'ts on how to instruct, how to be an instructor, and they would videotape us giving classes as part of our training, and we would look at the tapes with the teachers, and they would critique us and point out what we're doing wrong, what we're doing right. And there was a final test for that also, to graduate from that. They would observe you actually giving classes. You would get your lesson plan. Lesson plans were pre-made. You'd go over your lesson plan. Of course, you had to know your subject. And you would go out on the floor and give a class to the students. And they would grade you on it. And if they thought you were going to be a good instructor, you would pass. If not, they'd send you back for more training. But I got through that okay.
Mm-hmm.
Finished the 2 weeks. And they made me an instructor on the second shift in the 10th week, which was, of course, the map reading week.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the other 11 weeks is what I wanted. I got the 10th week. So I ended up for 8 or 9 months teaching map reading, how to use a compass, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was permanent party. I had the family came down and stayed with me. We lived in a trailer off post. And at that time, it was an 8-hour day, but all us instructors got together, and instead of doing 2 hours on the floor in the morning at 2 in the afternoon, but you had to be there all 8 hours, we would rearrange the schedule and do 4 hours in the morning and have the afternoon off. So that was pretty good duty. We'd get our 4 hours of teaching time in half a day, and then the rest of the time was free. And they didn't seem to care, you know, as long as we okayed it with the higher-ups and the teaching got done. We didn't mind spending 4 straight hours on the floor. Well, I call it 4 hours. It was a 45-minute class with a 15-minute break. So we would get our 4 hours in and then have half a day off, free time to do whatever we wanted, you know, go back home or, you know, go back to our trailer or be with the family and so forth. But that wasn't too bad. I enjoyed my time as an instructor. And I was in a company of instructors. There was 900 in the company, and that's a large company.
Mm-hmm.
Most battalions don't have that many people, but there was so many instructors at the Southeastern Signal School at the time that that particular company was 900 people. I don't know how the first sergeant kept up with everybody.
Yeah.
But I was a private E2. When I finished MOS training, and here I was a private E2 teaching classes on the floor to a lot of PFCs and Spec 4s coming through there, you know, National Guard and guys that had been in the Army longer than I had. And I always thought that was kind of funny. Here's a private E2 teaching Spec 4s and sergeants, you know, about radios.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of us private E2s doing this, and there was no slots open to promote us in that. It was such a large company, they just couldn't promote us. So, in fact, I didn't make PFC until I got to Vietnam. So I went over there a private E2.
Goodness.
And made PFC almost immediately, and I think within 3 months, I had made Spec 4, and I had made Acting HA, Acting Jack E5, but they needed an NCO at one of the outsites. And I think within 4 months, I had gone from E2 to E5.
Wow.
So what I didn't get in that 9 months at Fort Gordon, made up for it when I got to Vietnam. I got promoted real fast through the ranks.
Yeah. Now, what MOSs were covered there at the Signal School at Fort Gordon? Was it just yours or all Signal MOSs?
It was all Signal MOS. It was a huge operation.
Yeah.
It was the course I was with was just the 31M, 31 mic.
Right.
And it was hectic. It was three classes a day, 8 hours. It was 24-hour operation. Any time of day or night, you know, you'd hear the troops marching through the Fort Gordon, going to or from class, chow, the mess halls were up 24 hours. Everything was 24 hours. It was really hectic. It was, they just needed so many guys. They just needed so many signal people to support the guys in Vietnam. It was a huge signal presence in Vietnam. They were all over the place.
Yes, sir.
In fact, I've seen numbers, and I believe it from being over there, that for every guy in the boonies, for every infantryman, there was 8 or 9 support personnel over there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why in 1969, late 68 to early 69, it was the highest troop strength was 580,000 American troops over there.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, 85% to 90% of them were what they call support troops.
Mm-hmm.
That was including the offshore Navy, you know, everything.
Mm-hmm.
But
While you were in signal training and then while you were an instructor there at Fort Gordon,
yeah.
How much did you hear about Vietnam, and how did you start meeting other veterans that were coming back from tours of duty?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You know, like I say, it was just the only people I saw were the students,
right,
and the guys in my company. I don't know what these guys coming back from Vietnam were going. They weren't going to Fort Gordon.
Okay.
They were going to permanent duty stations elsewhere.
Yeah.
A lot of guys would come back to the States and get orders for Germany or something. You know?
Yeah.
Or Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up both of those places during my 10 years. But no, I didn't meet many Vietnam veterans at all.
Okay. And let's see. Would you give me the dates that you were at Fort Gordon?
Yeah, let me think now. I was there. Let's see.
Well, if it was
August, September, October.
Uh-huh.
I was a basic.
Right.
So from say November.
Uh-huh.
And in 9 months, whatever 9 months is, that'd be late summer of. No, it'd be early fall of 60.
Right.
68. So I was at Fort Gordon. Say January through October.
Okay.
Of 68.
Well, then, you were there when Tet 68 took place.
Yeah.
Did you hear much about
that? Didn't hear much about it.
You didn't?
Just what I saw on the 6 o'clock news.
Uh-huh.
Basically, that's all I remember of that.
Okay.
The one thing I do remember when I was at Fort Gordon,
mm-hmm,
was I was going to work one morning at 6:30 in the morning, and the previous night, Kennedy got shot out in California. That sticks out in my mind. I didn't even hear about that until about 8 or 9 hours after it happened.
This is Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
And that was, of course, that shocked everybody. But
yeah.
Like I said, I didn't hear about it until 8 or 9 hours later because I had been sleeping all night.
Mm-hmm.
Heard it on the radio, car radio, going to teach.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about other events while you were there? For instance, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election. Did that affect you at all? What did you think when he said he just wanted to quit?
Was that in 68 he did that?
Yes, sir. Just after Tet.
Now, all I remember of that is what I've seen on since then.
Okay.
You know, I've seen the clip 100 times on
TV.
But I didn't see the speech.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll
You're busy.
But at the time, no, I don't recall that at all.
And, let's see. Did you, in terms of your training as a signal person, and I guess in terms of your specific MOS dealing with relays and things of that nature,
yeah.
was there anything special that they trained you in concerning doing what you would have to do in the jungle versus, say, I mean, you know, your job would vary, I would imagine, depending on the environment that you're in. No?
Right. Well, we always needed the high ground.
Right.
So I didn't see a jungle the whole time I was over there. I was outside in a Trang with the Koreans for 6 months up on a hill.
Okay.
And we always had to have the high ground because we had line of sight antennas.
Okay. So you had to physically be able to, you know, technically be able to see. You weren't.
You had to have a clear shot of 40 miles.
Right.
There could be nothing higher than your antenna between you.
Yeah.
Well, there was ways around that, too. You could bounce them off mountains sometimes if the conditions were right, but it was called line of sight.
How about bounce off the ionosphere, things like that, or the atmosphere?
No, we didn't get into that. That was HF band and other radio teletype stuff like that.
Yeah.
Our frequencies were... it's a small frequency range, and it was strictly line of sight.
Okay. Okay. So it didn't, being in a specific type of environment doesn't affect your job as long as you're at
the
highest train.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right.
How about foul weather, though?
I saw it all in my career.
Right.
Everything from German blizzards in the middle of winter field exercises to the one thing I remember about Vietnam was the dust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so dry during the dry season that and so many choppers blowing up dust all the time and trucks and stuff. It was very dusty.
Mm-hmm.
It was a red kind of a dirt soil in the area I was in. It got impregnated into your pores, you know, because you're always taking cold showers and stuff, you know. Very rarely had a hot water.
Yeah.
And that's basically what I remember. Is, during the monsoon, the wet season, it would rain every afternoon. But during the dry season, it was really dry. A lot of dust. We had a lot of problems with filters and the equipment and filters and generators and so forth.
Well, how would you... well, we should talk about that when we get to...
Yeah, we'll get to that.
When we talk about your time in Vietnam. Okay. But I would assume they talked about strategies and ways of dealing with those types of environmental issues during your training.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What to do in all conditions.
Right.
The Army covers everything.
Right.
Desert to jungle, the Arctic.
Okay.
And the equipment is built to withstand that.
Yes.
Just as an aside, when I first started working at Aberdeen Proving Ground here, we were testing a new generation of generators for the Army. They were changing from gasoline to diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed at the battery of tests that they put this stuff through before they even go into production, before the Army will buy it. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's another story.
Yeah.
But
okay.
We'll get back to here.
Well, let's see. Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss?
On the training?
In terms of training and your preparation for Vietnam?
The training in the MOS was more than adequate.
Okay.
The training for what to expect in Vietnam was inadequate.
Okay.
Like I say, it was just 2 days of just guys telling us what it was like over there. You know?
Yeah.
We didn't know what to expect once we got there, really.
Yeah.
It was like culture shock once you got there.
Yeah. Well, that brings up, I wanted to ask you something else about the media. You mentioned that you obviously saw the news a lot and saw, you know, the film footage and heard the news stories concerning the Vietnam War. How did that television coverage that you saw mesh with the reality that you witnessed when you got on the ground in Vietnam? And, you know, did you find that the reporting that you had been exposed to prior to going to Vietnam was accurate or inaccurate?
What we saw in Georgia at that time during my training and during my stay as a instructor, you'd see the the clips of the body bags, and hear the reporters talk about how many U.S. troops were killed that day. You know, everybody saw that. Once I got to Vietnam, I didn't see much of that. I wasn't with the frontline troops. You know, didn't see a lot of gore and death that a lot of the grunts did. But I don't know if I was just young. And I was young at the time. I was in my early 20s, and just like most people that age, you know, we're invincible. There was no fear of going over there, and a little apprehension on what to expect, what the country was like and all, but the reports didn't really bother me that much. I knew eventually I'd be going over there, and I just faced the fact and waited till the time came.
Okay.
It was I wasn't afraid to go.
Right. Well, when you got your orders from Vietnam, you communicated that, I'm sure, with your family. What was their response?
My mother was upset.
Yeah.
But she knew it was coming, too. Or probably would. Some guys lucked out and got orders to Germany, but I'd say 80-85% of the guys went to Vietnam. Of course, we still had the NATO presence in Germany. A lot of guys had to go over there, but at 67, 68 was the big build-up in Vietnam, and most of the guys and most of their families knew they'd be gone sooner or later. You know, they were in training.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I say, I wasn't really upset. My mother was upset, of course.
Yeah.
At the time, I was separated from my wife.
Okay.
And wasn't communicating with her much.
Okay.
I don't really know what she felt. I know I had made out an allotment for her and my son, so they would have some money, but I don't know what her real feelings were.
Okay. Well, how about your brother? He was younger than you, right?
Yeah.
How old was he?
Let's see. He was of the age for 18, 19 at the time. He was just finishing high school. He knew he wouldn't be get drafted. He had a history of epilepsy, so he was 4F.
Okay.
He came down with these seizures when he was in high school, junior, senior year, and that's. To this day, I think his hard work that he was doing at the time, I was away in the Army, and he was home with Mom, going to school and working. He was working at a deli, a butcher shop, and he was pushing himself too hard, and he had a slight case of epilepsy, and it grabbed a hold of him from being tired all the time. He started having these seizures. Well, they got it under control with medication, and to this day, he takes that one pill a day, and he's okay. But he knew he wouldn't be drafted, and he went ahead, and he lived in Chester, Pennsylvania with my mother. When he finished St. James High School, he went immediately into college, which was, it's now Widener College. It used to be Pennsylvania Military College when he went.
Okay.
So he worked his way through college and took liberal arts courses and some accounting, and he ended up getting into the banking industry as you know, a trainee.
Mm-hmm.
So he did well. He got himself through college, got his degree, and has done well ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So like I say, he knew he wouldn't be drafted. Mm-hmm. And he pursued his own career at his own speed.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe what it was like going over? You know, what was your route, and I assume you flew over, and what was that flight like?
Yeah. Let's see. We left Fort Lewis, Washington, and we flew the Great Circle route up, stop at Anchorage, Alaska, refuel. I remember it being a long flight. It was, I think, 15 hours total. We hit Anchorage, and we hit somewhere in Japan, and then Vietnam. And all I remember of the flight, it was a Boeing 707, which held about 220 people, three seats, an aisle and three seats, a great big plane. And it was all, you know, service people. We got to Vietnam. Of course, we crossed the international date line. And we lost a day somewhere along the way. We left on one day, got there 2 days later. Got to the processing center. That's where they assign you to a company or a battalion. And I wasn't there too long. Mm-hmm. I was there 2 days, I believe. Parts of 2 days. And the second day I was there, while they were getting all my assignment and all squared away, they put you on details, sandbagging details or, you know, doing something just to keep you busy. And the immediate thing I remember of that first full day was the heat, humidity, and the sandbag detail. And luckily I was a wiry little guy at that time, and didn't bother me too much. But the guys that weren't used to the heat and stuff like that, they had a problem first couple of days, from the heat and humidity, and then working hard out in the sun and so forth. I do remember on the sandbag detail, a couple guys got not heat stroke, but they got weak in the knees from the heat, you know, some kind of heat problem, and they had to take them off it. But it's like anything else. You get acclimated in a couple of weeks. You get acclimated to the weather. And that's basically what I remember at the processing center was the heat. And then the end, towards the late afternoon of the second day, I got my orders to report to a signal company in the Trang at Camp McDermott. And they flew us down in the Trang in some kind of cargo plane. I think it was a C-130. And I remember it was a short flight, like 20 minutes is all it was. And I remember the only thing I remember of the flight was the landing. We landed, that cargo plane landed and came to a full stop, I think, within 200 or 300 yards. I mean, that plane could just drop down out of the sky and hit a runway and stop on a dime. So they got us off the plane, and there was trucks there waiting for us to take us from the Trang Airport to Camp McDermott, which was only like a mile or so away.
Okay. What date do you remember that you arrived in Vietnam?
It must have been on or about the 1st of November.
Okay.
Either the last day of October or the 1st of November.
Okay.
I think I got to my company on the 1st or 2nd of November in 68.
Okay. And that was the Company A of the 459th Signal Battalion?
Right.
Okay.
Right. At Camp McDermott, they had their main communications center there. It was like the hub of that battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their outlying sites that they shot their radio shots to. There was one in what was called North Nha Trang, which was, of course, north of the city. And there was one called West Nha Trang, which was 22 miles west of the city out in the boonies.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a shot to Han Tre Island, which was out in the bay of Nha Trang.
Okay.
So, I worked the mid-1970 midnight to noon shift. Mm-hmm. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked the night shift. Like I say, I was an E2 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And would report to the site just before midnight, and they would have, they had 8 or 9, might have even been 10 vans of equipment with the different shots in them. And of course they had a little compound built around it. They had this PVC, they called it. It was like metal grating.
Mm-hmm.
That they would put up against the vans and sandbag, a whole bunch of sandbags around everything. And it was like a bunker built around the vans. And of course, out a little further out in the yard, they had all their antennas, their array of antennas. And it was a permanent signal site, and it was already well established when I got there. It was mm-hmm. just a matter of reporting for work and keeping the radios running. We had commercial power most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We did have these big 100 kW generators as backup, but we didn't even have to mess with them because they had Vietnamese contractors who were in charge of those. They maintained them and kept them ready to go online as soon as a power outage happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they were Vietnamese nationals. So basically, it was just doing our combo circuit checks every hour and keeping the radios aligned and keeping the circuits clear.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all kinds of different circuits. We had voice. We had facsimile circuits. We had teletype circuits. And we had a lot of the circuits were secure circuits.
Mm-hmm.
We had secure equipment on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had not only radio shots that would relay these circuits around, we also had hardwire landline shots into the Trang. And from their comp center in the Trang, they would go all over the country by landline.
Okay.
So it was a pretty big signal site. A lot of different kinds of circuits
yeah.
on them.
Now, how effective were the facsimile circuits and the facsimile capabilities at that time?
They were pretty effective. It was hard to keep them online. There was a lot of problems with them. So much that could go wrong with them, you know what I mean? The equipment was very touchy,
mm-hmm.
and it was all tube technology, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was digital yet.
Right.
So you were forever, not forever, but a lot of nights you were working on circuits all night long because you had to keep them up.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of babying the circuits, you know, and working with other operators down the line and switching equipment here and there
mm-hmm.
just to keep these things online.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
You'd have your slow times, but yeah. you were hustling pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd get on the phone circuits, and you might be talking to a Korean down in Longbin or Saigon. You
mm-hmm.
know, you don't know what he's saying. He doesn't know what you're saying, so you'd have to get an interpreter on there and work the circuits out with him.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of Australians in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, and I never got to deal with too many of them, but once in a while you get some Australians on there. They're always fun to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, a lot of working on the circuits, changing bad equipment or troubleshooting, you
mm-hmm.
know. So it kept you pretty busy for 12 hours.
Yes,
and that 12 hours, you had two meal breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You'd relieve each other to go. We had a mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
Go get something to eat. And so it was just 12 hours. You were working.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily, I had the night shift. It wasn't too hot. The nights were, you know, fairly cool.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty nice. Except during the rainy season. And then it was a mess. just a camper. It was a big mud hole for like 3 months. He got used to that too.
Right. Okay. Well, let me go ahead and pause this for a moment, sir.
Yeah.
This will end interview number one with Mr. William Moore. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. William Moore on the 20th of December, year 2001, at approximately 3:40 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Moore is in Elkton, Maryland. Sir, why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about some of your first experiences upon arriving in Vietnam, and if you would, could you describe any kind of briefings that you received that you remember?
On arrival?
Yes, sir.
No briefings. We arrived at a processing center. And we were assigned to a unit by someone, by MOS, which is our military occupational specialty.
Yes, sir.
And then after 2 days there at the processing center, we were flown to our destination. And mine was only a 10-minute flight. I flew to Nha Trang. I was assigned to the 459th Signal Battalion, and the battalion trucks picked us up, took us to the battalion area at Camp McDermott, which was just on the south end of the train by the airfield.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
And I was subsequently assigned by the battalion to Company A. And there was four companies in that battalion.
Yes, sir.
And I think I mentioned on the last part of the last hour we did that I worked at the COMO site, communications site there. It was a permanent site, a well-established site. It had been there quite a few years, so
okay.
Everything was already in place when I got there. We were just relieving the guys that were leaving. You know, it was a one-year tour,
mm-hmm.
So once your tour was up, somebody replaced you. That's how that worked.
Okay.
So I had I was assigned to the midnight to 12 noon shift. It was 7 days a week. And we had to keep the circuits and all the radio shots up on the air.
Right.
We had commercial power at that site,
mm-hmm.
Commercial electric power with backup generators that were manned and kept in good working condition by Vietnamese nationals who were hired to do that job.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have anything to do with the generators. If we lost commercial power, they had us back on the air within minutes.
Wow.
They were pretty good at it.
Well, just out of curiosity, what was the morale of the unit like? And what were your impressions of the 459th Signal Battalion and then Company Alpha?
Well, 459th Signal Battalion was a typical signal outfit. They had many different signal MOSs. They had radio teletype. They had circuit controllers. They had mobile equipment that was mounted on trucks. They had permanent installations. In fact, this battalion had three, one at Camp McDermott, where I was, and one at a place called North Nha Trang, and one at a place called West Nha Trang. And it was like a round-robin relay shots to support the American and Korean units that were in that immediate area. They did have long-range radio shots and circuits that would go through us and be sent on down, further down country, down to Saigon, Long Bend, and places like that. So some of our circuits weren't local. They went all over the country through relays and so
mm-hmm.
forth. So the morale was good at the Camp McDermott. We were so busy all the time, you really didn't have time to have bad morale. It was you were either working or sleeping or... You did have 12 hours off. 7 or 8 of those were spent sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
During our free time, we were allowed to leave post, leave the camp, and we could go down to the beach. The Trang Bay was right there. The water was only like a half a mile away, and they had what was called the American Beach there. It was just for American soldiers. So you could go enjoy yourself at the beach. They had things to do there besides swimming and sunny. They had like a little miniature golf course, They had horseshoes and, you know, just something to keep you entertained during your off time.
Mm-hmm.
And on the camp itself, they had their EM club, enlisted men's club, and of course they had a little officer's club. And you could go there and enjoy a beverage of your choice and watch some of the shows that would come in from Saigon, or they had Vietnamese nationals that had all these little bands and all, and they would sing the popular American songs and entertain the troops. Of course, they would sing in phonetic English. You know, they would memorize their record just by it. They didn't really know the language, but you could figure out what they were saying.
Okay.
And so that's what we did in our spare time:
mm-hmm.
either beach or go to the club. Or sit in your barracks. They had a two-story wood frame buildings that were wood in the room waist high, and then the rest was screening. They were kind of open air, and they were divided off into rooms, and those were the barracks. The NCO would have a one- or a two-man room, and the lower ranks would have four to a room. So it wasn't too bad.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like you were sleeping in a sleep bag out in the swamp somewhere like a lot of the guys.
That's
right.
Nick, you just to keep on the theme of entertainment, did you see any major USO shows come through?
No, I never had the opportunity to see any of the USO shows.
Mm-hmm.
They were more or less targeted either towards the Saigon or really going out and into the boonies,
mm-hmm.
and to some camp somewhere where the infantry guys were, or the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have time to hit every support unit.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I never did see a USO show.
Okay. Were there any donut dollies or armies, the Army services? They ran a bunch of
there
libraries.
There were a few on Camp McDermott. You may see an Army nurse once in a while down if they had a medical facility.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any kind of donut dollies. I don't remember any kind of... they didn't have a USO club or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And were there any women in the Signal Corps at this point?
No, there wasn't.
Okay.
If there were, they weren't in this part of Vietnam. I think the only women in the service that I ran into over there were lieutenant nurses,
mm-hmm.
In the medical corps.
Okay.
The big buildup of women troopers came later down the road after the war. In fact, when I was in Germany in a Signal Battalion, I think 30% of them were women by then, and that was in 73 to 76. Vietnam, that was, like I said, the only women I saw were an occasional nurse here or there, down at the medical facility.
Mm-hmm.
And they had more. They had a lot of nurses at the hospitals, in the bigger cities.
Mm-hmm.
But at the medical facilities, they may have one or two,
okay.
Assisting the doctors there.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's see. You spent how much time in Nha Trang?
I spent my whole year in the Nha Trang area.
Okay.
I spent a total of 6 months at Camp McDermott,
mm-hmm.
the first three and the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
The middle 6 months I spent at West Nha Trang Signal Site, which is about 20 to 25 miles west of the city limits.
Okay. Which site did you prefer working in?
Well, I preferred the relay site, the West Nha Trang site.
Okay.
Because there was only four of us there.
Mm-hmm.
I was in charge. We had our own schedule.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we kept the radios up, there was no Army hassle at all. There was, no formations,
mm-hmm.
and no extra duties, what happened was the E-5 who was in charge of that site was being rotated back to the States. His time was up. The CO asked me if I would go up and be his relief. And I said, how long am I going to be up there? And he said, probably around 6 months. So I was a Spec 4, and they promoted me to well, they put the paperwork in to promote me to sergeant, but they put the stripes on me early. They gave me acting sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me up there, and I relieved that fella and left. And like I said, it was me and three other people up there, two signal MOS fellows,
mm-hmm.
And one generator mechanic.
Okay.
And that was his job, keep the generators going, and my job was keep the site running.
Mm-hmm.
So we split the time up, two 12-hour shifts, two men on a shift,
mm-hmm.
7 days a week.
Okay. Well, so it sounds like a very similar work regimen.
Similar work, different living conditions.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your time first at Camp McDermott in that respect then. What was it like living there? How frequently did you have to deal with enemy contact in the form of mortaring or shelling?
Okay.
That kind of stuff.
Okay, in my total 6 months at Camp McDermott, our particular area of Camp McDermott, it was a big camp,
mm-hmm.
pretty spread out. In fact, the 5th Special Forces, the Green Berets, had their headquarters at Camp McDermott, but they were across post on the other side. But in my 6 months there, we only had two attacks. It was in our immediate area. One was a mortar attack, and one was a rocket attack. And that did not happen until my last 3 months at Camp McDermott, after I had done my 6 months up on the hill at West Matrain. So, and they were both middle of the night, like 2 o'clock in the morning. The closest one was the mortar attack. It was right in the company area.
Okay.
In fact, I think I sent you a story about that. I wrote a story about it.
Yes, sir, you did, and I do have it.
And the rocket attack, the closest rocket hit the chaplain's office right next to the commo site,
mm-hmm.
and totally wiped it out. I remember going down there the next day, and the chaplain was down there trying to recover something out of his files and all, but it did a pretty good job on his building he was using for an office.
Mm-hmm.
The chapel itself survived the attack. But that was the only two actual hostile fire that I encountered at Camp McDermott there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What were the general living conditions like as far as the barracks, the food, things like that?
Okay, the barracks were like I mentioned, a two-story wood frame, screen halfway up, little cubbyhole rooms broken off into rooms. The food was typical Army A-ration food. It was some of the best food you could buy, but prepared real bad, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't take many pains. They had too many guys to feed. It was a 24-hour operation. They had to just get this food out on the line for the guy. Like I say, it was good food. In fact, some of the food was bought locally, especially the bread.
Mm-hmm.
It was bought from Vietnamese sources. And you got used to the little flower bugs in there. The country was so humid, the bread was all full of bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And you hold the bread up to the light and see all these little things in there. But they were, they weren't alive. They'd been cooked. So you got used to that, and you just ate them after a while, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing you could do if you wanted to eat some bread. The milk was mostly powdered milk. The eggs were powdered eggs. They did get some good meat once in a while, but like I say, the preparation wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
They had canned vegetables, some local vegetables, plenty of Kool-Aid. They always had tubs and tubs of Kool-Aid. If you didn't like the powdered milk, you had your other choice was Kool-Aid.
Okay.
Now there was plenty of beer. They had a place where you could buy beer, cases of beer. You had a ration card, so you could buy, I think it was up to 6 cases of beer a month, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that drank a lot of beer would use their allocation up, and the guys that didn't drink beer would give them their, or go buy them the beer or give them their ration card to use.
Mm-hmm.
But we were allowed so much, 6 cases of beer a month, I think 2 bottles of whiskey, ration, with a ration, controlled ration cart. And they did have a place on post where you could get that. It was all government controlled. You signed for, and each bottle of whiskey had a, like, it wasn't a barcode, it was like a number on it, so they could track it to stop the black market activity. So that's the reason they marked them like that. So if you went and bought a bottle of whiskey,
mm-hmm.
and it ended up being found, say, in the Trang in somebody else's possession, you know, some bar down there, you were in big trouble.
Do you know of anybody who actually got in trouble for that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
really?
There was a lot of illegal black market activity over there, and there were a lot of guys involved with it, and not just enlisted men, a lot of officers and higher rank officers. And once in a while, they would get caught, and then the UCMJ would move in, and they would be, you know, court-martialed.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it was worth the chance to them because it was big money, you know. In fact, if I can, a little aside here,
mm-hmm.
when I was on the, up on the hill, every other Sunday, two of us would have a Sunday off. Going into Trang, you know, drive one of the vehicles into the Trang, and go to the officers' club or EM club for a decent meal. Because all we had up on the hill was sea rations and rice. And maybe stop in a bar now and then. Well, I was in this bar one night, and the lights went out. They had a commercial power failure, which they had all the time over there. And a couple minutes later, the lights come on, and they flickered a little bit, and I hear these generators running. So I walked out the back door, and there in the alley was two... on a trailer was two brand-new Army generators. Didn't have 3 or 4 hours on them each, you know. So the Vietnamese national, the owner of the bar, somehow on the black market got this generator set for his backup power. And we're up on the hill there with these old generators with 1,000 hours on them trying to keep them running. That's the kind of stuff, you know, would make you angry.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, back to Camp McDermott.
Well, if I could, a follow-up question on that particular
yeah.
incident. Wasn't there somewhere you could go to report that kind of stuff? I mean, obviously this person had no right owning that, and
uh-huh.
they got it illegally. And so why didn't did the Army not have a system set
yeah,
up?
Yeah, they had the CID, civil...
Right,
CID, but...
Where they would go and confiscate that equipment and bring it back and
right,
give it
right.
to whoever needs it in the military.
Right.
They were supposed to do that, but it didn't happen?
Well, a lot of times it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, everybody knew this stuff was going on, but it was just so big, it's, you know, you're the little peon, you know.
All right.
Who's going to listen to me, you know?
Well, yeah, you must have been very frustrating at
it was.
Many levels.
After a while, you know, you just get the attitude, I want to get my year in and get out of here, you know.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you still had to do your job, and you still had to, you were in the military, you still had
right.
to keep your nose clean.
Right.
Just try to get through it, you know.
Well, while you were there at Camp McDermott, and just to clarify, is this Camp McDermott or Camp Crockett or both?
What was I calling it?
In the,
Camp McDermott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here today you called it Camp McDermott, but I was curious because in some of the things that you wrote that you sent to me, you refer to a site
called...
Oh, no,
it's Camp McDermott.
Oh, okay.
It's a made-up name
okay.
in this story.
Oh, gotcha,
yeah.
Okay. Camp McDermott, while you were there, who were you primarily supporting there?
We were... Oh, I forget what brigade it was. Some Army brigade level had all their control circuits
mm-hmm.
so that their officers could... talk to other officers and, you know, and then it's mostly circuits for, like, say, majors on up, you know, control circuits
mm-hmm.
so that the units could talk to each other.
Okay.
And then, of course, they would make the decisions on, and pass the stuff on down to their units, you know. And we also had some Korean circuits came through Camp McDermott from West Training, which they shot on down to a place called Cholon Rock, R-O-K.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Korean outfit down near Saigon.
But that's when you were at West Nutra.
Yeah, but we would shoot them
to
Camp McDermott, uh-huh. And they would shoot them on down the line. See,
oh, wow.
It was only like 40-mile hops on line of sight.
Okay, right, okay.
So it just keep relaying the stuff.
And though there were I assume that there were as many relays as were necessary to go from the northern tip of South Vietnam down to the very southernmost.
No,
tip,
well,
or no.
You would have relays, say, from, you'd go 40 miles to a relay, and he'd shoot at 40 miles.
Right.
But then all the circuits were multiplexed onto telephone lines, landlines.
Oh, right, okay. And the landlines would also carry stuff.
Right,
okay.
And besides the landlines, you'd have the teletype and facsimile circuits.
Okay.
On your shot.
Mm-hmm.
So we had all three.
Now, the facsimile, could you explain? Is that the same?
As today.
It is the same as
except
today.
It wasn't digital. It was analog.
Right.
It was all tube equipment,
right.
Antiquated stuff.
But
it worked.
But it was the same thing as far as you put in
a piece of paper
on one end, and it would come out on
right.
A piece of paper at the other end.
Yeah. And they call them telex.
Yeah.
You know, a different name for them. We call them facsimile circuits.
How clear were they on the other end? How clear were
the voice circuits?
No, the facsimile.
Oh, pretty good. Readable.
Okay.
You know, wasn't the quality you have today, but, you know,
right.
It was legible.
That's
all they wanted.
Right.
All they needed.
That's right. And what was the voice quality?
Voice quality, if the circuits were tuned up and at their peak, it was just like we're talking here.
Wow.
But it wasn't that way all the time. Mm-hmm. You were continually working on the circuits. All kinds of things could go wrong. There's so many places they went through, and you'd have ringers and other. You'd have your ringers on them, and the ringers would go bad, and you'd have to work on that, find out whose end was bad, you know, and switch the equipment out, or you'd get static or crossover, or you had to watch, you know, where your lines ran. You couldn't be any near any high voltage lines or anything like that. So. You had your hourly checks. You rang down every circuit, every hour that you were assigned.
Mm-hmm.
And the operator on the other end, you would check them out. Keep them as clean as you could. Because, like I say, they were all command and control circuits.
Mm-hmm. So, as far as what you would do, your primary responsibility was to maintain?
Well, to operate, maintain the, mm-hmm. The circuits.
Mm-hmm.
And the radio shots.
And you never really interjected, like you never got on and actually answered.
Oh, no.
On a radio call.
You could listen in.
Yeah, you could listen in.
But you had so many to check, you know.
Yeah.
You just whistle them down. Well, I said, there I go again, whistle them down. The ringers would break. Somebody bring their field phone. Say, well, at 1600 hertz. You could get on there and whistle at 1600 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
And whistle the other end down. That's how you would get the other operator on to check the circuits. It would break the ringer at 1600 frequency.
So you'd whistle?
Yeah, you'd just go so you hit 1600 hertz and the other end of the phone would ring.
Well, that's amazing.
That's how the ringers were designed, to trip or ring at 1600 hertz. But back then they called them cycles per second. Now they're hertz.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all the operators did that. But see, you were in the middle. You weren't at the end where the phone was, where you cranked the handle and it sends 90 volts to the ringer and tripped the ringer.
Right.
So you just get on here and whistle it then.
Huh.
We had the ringers in our rigs, but there was no button to push or anything to make them break. It needed 90 volts.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, let's see. Do you recall any particular high peak times as far as the traffic coming through your your station there at Nha Trang? Maybe during major
high
operations?
High peak times were when there was an attack somewhere, when the youth was getting hit.
Right.
Or the day shift had a lot. You know, it was like 8 to 5 when everybody, all the officers and all, were up and about during the duty hours. That was the high peak time of the day shift. That's why I enjoyed the night shift so much. It wasn't high peak traffic used normally. And you had time, you know, you had more time to, you weren't as going as hectic as the day shift.
And when, was it ever possible that the circus became overloaded?
Overloaded?
Mm-hmm.
No. No, they were individual circuits.
Right.
And just two-wire circuits for each one. You know. No, there was no overload problem at all.
Or not? Maybe overload's a wrong expression. Just all the circuits are busy. You know, like we get now with sometimes really
high.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they were sole user circuits. One end would be, say, a major talking to the other end to, say, a general or something. So they were sole user circuits. So they were only busy when those two particular people were using them. Well, I take it, some of the circuits would go into a command center somewhere, and there may be 3 or 4 officers using it. And they would get pretty busy during an attack or something, where they'd have to direct their men, you know, their units, where to go and what to do and stuff. But it wasn't like a whole lot of different people had access to these individual circuits. No, no problem with that.
Well, so how many simultaneous communications could you have coming through your station?
Oh, okay. Through one rig, you would have 48 channels,
okay.
24-channel system. And we had about 12 rigs at big combo site. So, what, 12 times 48, that's over 500 circuits coming through that signal site. Constantly, it's 24 hours, you know, you had to keep them up. So that was our mission, keep those circuits up. Well, you had to keep the radio shots up or you'd lose all 48 circuits because they were all modulated on the radio frequency. Passed down the line. So if a radio went down, those 48 channels were out until you got it back up.
Did that ever happen?
Oh, yeah. It happened all the time. Yeah, radios would go down. You'd have, say you'd have, if you were out on one of the op sites, like West of Triangle or North Triangle, and the generator went down, you'd be down 10, 15 minutes until you got out there and got the other generator fired up and switched the load over to that generator. But we tried to. They kept track of that, too. Not they, meaning the signal officers in the unit. They kept track of the downtime. And part of your performance was the less downtime you had, the better performance rating you would get. Because they had a thing back in those days called superior performance pay. Above and above your combat pay, you could get, I forget what it was, $35 or $50 a month extra if you were rated as a superior performance signalman for that year, okay? You were like evaluated every year with a written test, operational test, and evaluation of your superior officer, your signal officer. And if you passed all three of those, you were entitled to this extra pay.
Huh.
So, yeah, they could track all that stuff.
Did you ever pick up transmissions that were not of of American origin? That you weren't supposed to? Or that
you could get crosstalk on the circuits. You could pick up on your radio shots, especially at dusk and dawn when the ionosphere is changing. You could get interference. And in that case, you would just go into your SSI, which is the standing signal orders, and go to an alternate frequency or something. Frequencies would change quite often, just about every day. You would have to retune the radios to different frequencies.
Do you know if you ever accidentally picked up enemy transmissions?
No, not at the frequency range we worked at.
Okay.
The enemy had mostly FM range, small, you know, radios, like field radios.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, we never got any kind of interference from their stuff. Or they, of course, couldn't pick them up either because we weren't on the same, we weren't even near the same frequency band.
Okay. And do you know, well, were there any measures taken to prevent eavesdropping onto that communication system?
Yes. For the real important circuits, they call them crypto circuits. We
okay.
had encryption equipment built in on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Which would scramble the stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that if anybody did happen to tap in, they wouldn't know what was going on anyway.
Okay.
Coded. It would be encrypted at one end, sent through our stuff,
mm-hmm.
and deciphered at the other end
okay.
with the encryption equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have a small percentage of those kind of circuits, too, especially to the higher level, like a core level, where the generals are and everything.
Yes, sir.
We had some of those.
Okay. So do you remember any offensives that occurred while you were there at Camp McDermott where the traffic was real heavy and you guys were real busy?
Yeah. Yeah. The 5th Special Forces, which was there, got hit with a rocket and mortar attack
mm-hmm.
one night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a cross post, but you could still see the rockets coming in and hear the explosions over there. It was only maybe half a mile away,
mm-hmm.
and we were real busy that night.
Okay.
And I got to tell you a funny story about that.
Mm-hmm.
The one of the rockets made a direct hit on the 5th Special Forces ice cream parlor, which was the one and only real ice cream parlor in country. The 5th Special Force Green Berets had it. And they would have real ice cream. I don't know how they did it. Their commanding officer or somebody had some connection flown in from the United States. And you could go over there and sit down and have a real milkshake. And the rockets came from the mountains immediately behind Camp McDermott there. And those mountains had caves in, and the enemy would use them sporadically for storing equipment or, you know, for a short time and then moving it further down the line or wherever they wanted to move it in the province. Well, the next couple of days, the 5th Special Forces went out en masse and cleaned out those caves once and for all. And I think it was because they blew up their ice cream pump. It really pissed them off. the immediate next day, the jets came in
and
did the bombing and stuff. And then the Special Forces guys went out there on foot
mm-hmm.
and took care of the matter themselves.
Did they ever replace it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was within a week they were up and running again.
Okay.
You know, you had it. I guess they figured you got to do something to make it like home. So they had the ice cream parlor.
Mm-hmm. Did that help with morale?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you go in there and have a ice cream soda. I mean, not just 5th Special Forces. Anybody was welcome. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And you paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, there was a charge for it. But it was great.
Well, what kind of communication did you have with home? Did you get a lot of letters? Were you able to make calls or anything like that?
I called one time, believe it or not, I got all the way through. The phone was ringing here in Chester, Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
when somebody broke the circuit. I called from the mountain down to the Trang,
mm-hmm.
got on the long line down to Long Bend, and they got me down to Bangkok, and Bangkok got me to the Philippines. And this was in the middle of the night,
mm-hmm.
which was, I don't know what time it was in Philadelphia. I had no idea. All I knew is they were a day behind us, and I was on the other side of the world, so I didn't know what day or time it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally got to Hawaii and then to California. I got a real AT&T operator in California who called my mother's number, and I think on the third ring we lost the connection somewhere. But yeah, I got all the way through.
Wow.
I just wanted to see if I could do it. It worked.
Did you ever talk to your mom about that afterwards to see if
I told her about it. In fact, I wrote her about it. I said, I had your phone ringing sometime, you know, I don't know what time it was, but the third ring, I got disconnected.
Do you know if she remembered hearing it?
No. It must have been the middle of the night. She might have been asleep. I don't know.
Well, you mentioned earlier the mortar attack, and I assume that's the same mortar attack that...
Yeah, that's real vivid, and I put it down in a short story now.
Right, and there was a basketball court and basketball...
Right, they had poured a concrete court,
mm-hmm.
and our company,
mm-hmm.
of course, all the companies around would use it, but,
mm-hmm.
and they even installed lights so they could play it after dark.
Mm-hmm.
And when they finished playing around 10 or 11 o'clock, whenever it was, they left the lights on, which really stood out.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't real blackout conditions at Camp Derwent, but, you know, at night, after 9 o'clock, it was lights out. And nobody picked up on it, and I guess that's what they zeroed in on, because they were right in the company area. You know, around the 20 or so rounds landed right,
mm-hmm.
in a not too big a cluster, maybe 50-yard diameter.
Was anybody seriously injured?
Yeah, there was two guys got very serious shrapnel wounds, but they survived. No one was killed that night.
Okay. And did the mortar attack take out the basketball court?
No, it didn't. The mortars are funny. As soon as they touch the ground, they go off.
Yeah.
They don't leave a hole or a crater or anything.
They
blow up and out at 45 degrees and shrapnel.
Yeah.
So, no, it didn't really damage the concrete at all. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what about during the mortar attack that took out the ice cream parlor? At
that was a rocket attack.
Oh, a rocket attack.
5-inch diameter rockets they had.
Right. Did that...
They were Russian made.
Okay. Did that cause many casualties?
Yeah. The 5th Special Forces lost some guys that night.
Killed or just wounded?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Killed and wounded.
Yeah.
It was pretty serious. It was a dozen or so rockets right in their area.
Yeah. So perhaps that might have also added to the motivation to go out to the caves.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
They're a pretty tight outfit.
Yes, sir.
They still are. They always have been.
Yes, sir.
In fact, it was amazing during the war. I when I was in Vietnam at Camp McDermott, I saw 22-year-old E-6s, 25-year-old E-7s. So they made ranks so fast over there,
mm-hmm.
during the wartime. Normally it would take a person 12 to 15 years to make E-6 or E-7,
mm-hmm.
but not during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I made Hard Stripe E-5. I went from E-2 to E-5 in about 4 months. If I got country, I got country as an E-2, which is a private.
Mm-hmm.
I made PFC Spec 4 and Sergeant within 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So, the one good thing about it was it was easy to make rank. You could move up pretty quick.
What were the rules about your personal activities, and especially with regard to interacting with the Vietnamese civilians around Camp McDermott? Were there any rules?
Not really. No. Like I say, you were free to go off post.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't in... The Trang itself was not what was called a free fire zone. Only when you got outside of the city where there was a curfew, a free fire zone, you couldn't go certain areas after dark.
Okay.
And he wouldn't want to. But the Trag itself, in fact, we had quite a contingent of civilian Vietnamese working on the post. You know, you had your the women doing the laundry and the guys doing the whatever jobs they, the Army had for them. You know, the contractors and so forth, digging ditches or whatever, building buildings, you know. So we had quite a force of Vietnamese people working hand in hand with us on post there, doing their job, not working, you know, hand in hand with the signalers, but doing their job right on post.
Mm-hmm.
And they were supposedly clear. They all had ID cards and so forth. But I'm sure there was some VC spies, you know, in there. You couldn't really tell who was VC, though.
Mm-hmm.
But there were occasions when a lot of them wouldn't come to work. We knew something might be up. You know, they knew something was up.
Mm-hmm.
Might be an impending attack or something. The whole time I was at Camp McDermott, there was never a ground force assault on Camp McDermott. Mm-hmm. Just harassment with rockets and mortars.
Mm-hmm. What was the primary source of news for you?
The Army newspaper. What the heck did they call it?
Pacific Stars and Stripes?
Yeah, Stars and Stripes, right. That was it. Once in a while, you could catch some news on TV, but that was generated in country by the Army, too.
Mm-hmm.
They had a television network. And, of course, they had the Armed Forces Radio.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Okay.
In fact, I didn't know we had landed on the moon until about a week after it happened.
Oh, goodness.
My mother sent me a front page of the Chester Times.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was pretty remote.
Yes, sir. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about with regard to your first 6 months there at Camp McDermott?
No, that about covers Camp McDermott.
Okay.
I think, let's see. Yeah, I covered what we did in our off time. Like I say, it was 12 hours of work in a day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's about all I can think of right offhand.
Okay. Oh, one last question.
Yeah.
In terms of other recreational activities, was it mostly drinking, or were there other ways of
There was other things. There was they had a library there.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Well, I explained about the beach. You could go down there and play putt-putt golf or play horseshoes or play volleyball, you know. But other than the clubs, that's where the live entertainment was. There was, and the library, that was about it. There was no USO. There was no entertainment center, they call them, that they had on all the posts now, where you could go check out some instruments and play your own music or go listen to music. They had nothing like that there.
Okay. How about drug use?
It was pretty rampant through the lower ranks. In my experience at Camp McDermott, most of the NCOs were more into the beer and the whiskey drug abuse. And it was a lot. That was pretty rampant, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was a war zone. The guys, it was an escape, whether it be the drugs or the booze. It was more of a, you know, off-duty escape just to get through.
What was included in the drugs as opposed to alcohol?
The big things in the drugs was marijuana, plenty of that. It would come in from Cambodia, before they get it from the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese marijuana wasn't that great, they said. The there was opium, which is the hard drug. That's what they make heroin out of eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty rampant. And then there was the mixture. They would put opium with the marijuana and smoke it. So that's mostly what was opium and, heroin was pretty big, too. But a lot of guys died from heroin overdoses over there because it was so pure. wasn't like in the States where it might be 10%. Over there it was like 90%. So if they weren't careful, they could OD very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think, I would say the year I was there, it was pretty bad. Might have been at his peak. Well, it had to be at his peak, because that's when we had the peak troop strength there. We had 550,000 troops in country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so easy to get, and, you know, it was all over the place.
Mm.
Amazing.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's amazing. It was either, you were either, you abstained completely, or you were a druggie, or a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
or not a drunk, but you abused alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Was anybody ever caught and prosecuted for drug use?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For selling it. They had undercover people. CID had undercover people. You never knew who in the unit was a CID man.
Mm-hmm.
Could be the Spec 4 working next to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's people coming and going all the time with the rotation and all. And the new guy might be a narc, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of CID undercover. So they had to watch themselves. You know, they were into it heavy, especially in the selling it. They would probably eventually get caught. And then all they would do is court-martial them and kick them out of the Army with a dishonorable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you were offered that position as NCOIC of West Nha Trang.
Right.
What, did you hesitate at all, or did you figure, well, why not?
No, it was a bit of promotion, immediate mm-hmm. promotion coming up in the next
right.
month or so, and
right.
It was really kind of boring, the 12 hours down at this combo site every day, and not much to do in your off time. So, I said, yeah, I'll do it, and, but, you know, 6 months isn't bad. So I did my 6 months up there, but in fact, I did 6 months in 3 days. And I called the CO on the landline after I was over 3 days and said, hey, remember 6 months ago you said you were going to get some relief up here for me? By then I was tired of it up there, mainly because of the food situation and being dirty all the time. And, you know, I wanted to get out of there by then. And he says, oh, that's right, Sergeant Moore. He says, I'll have somebody up there in a couple of days. Sure enough, he had another E6, in fact, come up and relieve me. So,
at that point, it was time for you to rotate back home?
No, it was time to go back to Camp McDermott for my last 3 months.
Oh, your last 3 months.
And in fact, it was time for my R&R.
Oh, okay.
I decided to wait till I was there 9 months before I took my R&R.
Oh, gotcha.
And you get a 5-day R&R, and then when I came back country, I only had like 88 days left in country. My short-timer calendar was getting way down there.
Yes, sir. Well, when you worked up at Western Nha Trang, that was when you were working a lot with Koreans, is that right?
Yeah. We were 4 Americans. We had all Korean control artillery and control and command circuits going
mm-hmm.
through our site.
Mm-hmm.
24 channels only. Two shots, two 12-channel shots. Oh, wait, we did have one relay shot from north of the train that went through us back to the train, Camp McDermott.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had two terminal shots. We were the terminal for the Korean circuit.
Anything encrypted?
No. Okay. Nothing encrypted on that.
Now, so basically you were doing
didn't have to be. They were all talking Korean. Then we knew they were saying anyway. That was the problem working on the circuits. I had a Korean Army ROK troop that lived with us. He had been there this was his fourth year,
mm-hmm.
and he knew 5 languages.
Oh, wow.
And he lived in our hooch, and he was our interpreter on the circuits. Because Korean is really hard to learn. I couldn't learn any of, you know, their language in that short of time. So he would get on there and work the circuits with us,
mm-hmm.
interpret. In fact, he's another whole story himself. His name was Jung Go, and I'll tell you about him the next time. We call him Jungle for short.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew everything about Vietnam. He'd been there 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he stayed so long, he was big time in the black market. He was making all kinds of money.
Mm-hmm.
And plus he was getting the Korean Army, their combat pay is equivalent of about three times the normal Army pay.
Wow.
And he was sending his money back to his family.
Mm-hmm.
He was Korean. His father, mother was Korean. His father was Japanese. And he was sending his money back home. And they were saving it for him because he wanted to start a business,
Okay. Eventually.
So he saved, made a lot of money and saved it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left, he was still there.
Okay.
I don't know how long he ended up staying there. But if you needed anything, he could get it. He was great. He knew the country inside out. He knew the language. He knew Japanese, Vietnamese, English, of course Korean,
mm-hmm.
and he even knew some French.
Wow.
The guy was amazing. But he's another whole story.
Well, did you need to leave now, or?
In a couple minutes, I got to get on up to the bowling alley.
Can't
leave my guys down.
That's right. It's a nice bowling night. Okay.
In fact, I think we're fighting for first place tonight.
Okay. well, then maybe we should go ahead and stop now.
Okay.
Let me put an end on this. This will end interview number two with Mr. Bill Moore. Thank you, sir. This is Steve Maxner continuing the interview with Mr. William Moore on the 11th of January 2002 at approximately 9:05 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Moore is in Elkton, Maryland. Sir, why don't we go ahead and pick up with a discussion about your time at West Nha Trang, and also we were going to talk about the Korean interpreter. So if you want to address those two in whatever way you want, we can
sure.
talk about them.
Okay. All right, I was promoted to acting buck sergeant, E5, and assigned to the West Nha Trang relay radio site. It was 22 miles inland from the Bay of Nha Trang. It was a small hill, and we had a commo site up there consisting of two shots. One relay shot, one terminal shot for the Korean headquarters battalion that was stationed there. Their control and artillery circuits. So I arrived in late February at the site. I had three American Army Signal Corps people with me. Or they were already there. I relieved the NCO in charge because he was rotating back to the state. So I took over as site chief as an acting sergeant. And most of our circuits were Korean circuits, so we had an interpreter who lived with us and was stationed with us. He belonged to the headquarters company of a battalion of Whitehorse ROK, that's Republic of Korean Troops. And his name was Jung Go, and of course everybody called him Jungle, that was his nickname. He was a very learned man, about, I'd say, 30 years old. He'd been in the Korean Army quite a while. He was a career man in the Korean ROK Army. He was well-versed in four or five languages. Of course, he knew English and Korean, and he knew Japanese. I think his mother was Japanese. And he knew Vietnamese, and he knew some French. So he was very helpful in as a liaison between us four Americans and the Koreans there. And he also helped a lot in working on the circuits. He was saving his money and sending it home. He wanted to start a business after the war. He'd been in Korea. This was his fourth tour, 4 years. And he knew everybody around in the Trang area. If we ever needed anything, he knew where to get it. And he had a lot of contacts. He also helped us in learning about the area. He knew where to go, where not to go, and when to go and when not to go. And he had, like I say, he had a lot of contacts in the Arvin, South Vietnamese Army, and the Koreans, and in the Americans. That's about all about junk go, what else would you like to know?
Well, why don't you go ahead and describe the site there at West Nutchop?
Okay, the site was almost at the top of the hill. It was down from the very top of the hill by an elevation of maybe 15 feet. But we were high enough where our antennas could make line of sight with our terminal that we were shooting to. At the very top of the hill was the command bunker for the headquarters battalion, our headquarters company of that particular Korean battalion. Around the perimeter of the top of the hill, there were 36 bunkers, two-man bunkers, where they would post their guards. And once in a rare while, we would have to pull some guard shifts at night. When they would send out half of their company at a time on what we call recon patrols. And they would be out for 3 or 4 days down in the valley. Now, down in the valley, there were three other companies of the ROK surrounding that mountain, and they were anywhere from 5 to 10 miles out. And they were the outpost of the Korean battalion. So we were pretty well protected because we were right in the middle at the hill there with the outlying companies surrounding our long-distance perimeter. The perimeter of our particular mountain had three different strands of barbed wire about 10 to 15 meters between the strands. And they had all kinds of things hanging on the barbed wire, cans and things that would make noise. And they had flares stationed out there that they could ignite. They also had of the 36 bunkers, there was a device in each bunker that could trigger 8 Claymore mines. So our perimeter was very well protected and well armed. However, when they would send half the company out, that would leave them, of course, with about, maybe 40 people left there. And, of course, the Korean officers didn't pull guard, so they would have maybe 25 Koreans to man those bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So they would only man about half of them, every other one. And the check guard, they call them, would come around every hour and check the bunkers. He would walk around the perimeter of the top of the hill and make sure nobody was sleeping and so forth. We were pretty well guarded. At the very bottom face of the hill was the Korean artillery battery, which consisted of 105-millimeter guns. And they would always have fire orders called in, and just about every day they'd be shooting somewhere in the area. And it was kind of noisy. Sometimes they would have a fire in azimuth right over the top of the hill, and we were just the right distance away where the retort of the gun and the round passing overhead would happen at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty noisy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were supplied by helicopter and truck. They would bring our fuel from Camp McDermott. They had a POL point down there, and they would truck our fuel to us for our generators in 55-gallon drums of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they would a couple of times I had to go down and pick up gas in our 5-ton truck that we had. We had a 5-ton truck, a ton-and-a-quarter truck, and a Jeep. And 18 55-gallon drums would fit on a 5-ton truck, the bed of the truck. So after a couple of trips down to Natrang to get gas on our own, me and one of my signal operators would drive down through the POL, fill up the 1855-gallon drums of gasoline. Of course, you always had spillage and slopping around the truck, and there's gas all over the truck. So driving back through Nha Trang and through the outlying villages, I got a little paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
So I called the CO and I said, look, how about convoying that stuff up there? It's really dangerous. One match or one grenade or one thing would just wipe out that truck with the gas unit and so forth. So after a couple of trips of that, he did convoy the fuel up to us. We didn't have to go get it. Of course, the signal, the shots that we had to be 24-hour operations, so two of us would pull day shift, 12 hours, and two of us would pull night shift. It was round-the-clock operation. The 6 months I was up there, there was only, I think, three instances where Charlie or the VC tried to get either to the guns down at the bottom of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And one particular time, he must have been just a suicide guy. He somehow got through the perimeter up the top of the hill, and he had a satchel charge in a pack on his chest, and he ran in. He was trying to get into the command post at the very top of the hill, and he did manage to get in there in the middle of the night and set that off. A bunch of the officers on duty and the sapper, of course, were killed.
Mm-hmm.
But that was an isolated incident. Another time, they tried to get into the 105s at the bottom of the hill, and the sappers also to try to blow up the guns.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many of them there were. There was more than a couple. There was maybe three or four. And one of them set off a trip flare with a trip wire, and of course that alerted the Koreans, and they immediately came running out to the gun and lowered one of the guns to zero elevation and set a fuse at 100 meters and fired one round that had what were called flechette rounds. It's like a barbed something like a straight fish hook with a barb on it. It was full of those.
Mm-hmm.
So the one flechette round annihilated the sappers that were trying to sneak through the wire and blow up the gun. They had all kinds of sophisticated weaponry in Vietnam, and the flechette round was one of the nastier ones. The condo patrols, like I say, would go out for 2 or 3 days at a time, half the company, and they would come back, and then the other half would go out. And the whole 6 months I was there, they only brought back one prisoner. The Koreans did not like the Vietnamese at all, and they would not take no prisoners. The reason they brought this one prisoner back, he happened to be a higher-ranking officer that they had captured. I think he was a major. He was an NVA, North Vietnam regular troop, and he was a major that was in intelligence. So he had a lot of information and papers and information in his head that they wanted to get out of him. So they did bring him back, and it was about a 2-day interrogation at the top of the hill there, which I wasn't involved in. But the Korean officers and Jung Go went up there to interview that person. And they, from what I understand, they did get a lot of information about troops in the area, enemy troops in the area, and so forth. But it was interesting to me that they didn't take prisoners. It just that one fellow they brought back. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let me see. The hill, there was so much going on up there. We had sea rations was our basic subsistence. We tried everything we could to liven them up. We'd mix them and make stews, and we'd add some peppers to them, or the Koreans would give us some rice. We tried making rice with it. And the Koreans subsisted on rice, kimchi, and bacon. That's all they had, so we would trade them some sea rations for some rice and bacon. Water was trucked in a water dolly. You know, the potable water, we had plenty of water. We would fill up our 55-gallon drum that was on a raised platform with a spigot and a nozzle. That was our shower. So it was cold showers for 6 months. And we were pretty dirty all the time from all the dust blowing around from the choppers. It was kind of a real fine red clay type dirt that would, you just couldn't keep clean without hot water. It would get into your pores. You'd have a little red tinge to you until you finally got somewhere to get a hot shower.
Mm-hmm.
I covered the food. Recreation, there was hardly any recreation because we were on duty all the time. However, every other Sunday, two of us could go down, drive to Natrang,
mm-hmm.
and see the sights in Natrang, maybe do a little bar hopping or go to the officers' club. The officers' club did let the enlisted men in. The officers' club was on the third floor of a hotel in Natrang. It was pretty nice. They had all the amenities of a stateside officers' club.
Mm-hmm.
They would have they had nice furniture, they had games, they had good food, and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and good whiskey. They got all the stuff from the States. The one particular instance, me and Mike Canterbury, one of my operators, it was our Sunday to go in. We went to a hotel on the top floor of the four-story hotel. The building, I think the highest building was five stories in the train.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't any skyscrapers. But there was a nice Vietnamese club up there. We went up there for lunch and a drink and talked with the girls, the hostesses, and so forth. And, of course, Mike, he liked to drink a lot, but he got pretty well drunk and closed the scene. And on the way out, he kicked the glass panel out of the door, the double swinging door, and immediately the manager started chasing us down the steps. Of course, we took off. And we hit the street, and I went one way, and Mike went the other. Of course, they chased him, and they finally caught up to Mike. He ran down some alley into somebody's house and told him, MPs, hide behind me. So they hid him in a closet. The MPs found him, and they dragged him in and back to the club. And he told me all this later because I went. I had to be back to the hill by 6. I knew the MPs would probably catch him, so I had to be back before dark. So I got back to the hill, and then he called me on the landline about 9 o'clock at night and said, well, I'm finally out of here. I settled up with the people, and they let me go with no charges. So he took a taxi from the train at 10 o'clock at night out to the base of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, was curfew, and he was taking a chance there, but he called me from the bottom of the hill, and I went down and picked him up. Then he told me the whole story, that they took him back to the club, and the manager said, if you pay for the window, I won't press any charges. So he says, well, I don't have any cash. Will you take a check? And I said, yes. There was American Express Bank in country there, and the train had a branch, and he had an account there. So he wrote him a check. And the next morning was Monday. He says, can I borrow the Jeep? I says, why? He says, I'm going to drive to the train and stop payment on the check. So he did. So anyway, the manager was out his money. But I still remember that incident. It's real clear in my mind. It was
mm-hmm.
so funny.
Mm-hmm.
So that was about our recreation. We did have a small basketball court that we built up there
mm-hmm.
on a flat area on the, where the Koreans would do their taekwondo exercises in the morning. The Army has the daily dozen of calisthenics, but the Korean infantry troops do what's called taekwondo, a martial arts, and it's a very offensive type of martial art.
Mm-hmm.
They were all real good at it, including not only the hands and feet, a lot of knife throwing, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did have a weightlift bench that we made, and we had a small set of weights. We did some exercise, my lifting weights. Mm-hmm. Of course, eating C rations, which are very high in protein, carbohydrates, we were all in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we ran around with no shirts most of the time. It was hot.
Mm-hmm.
We were all suntanned, and we all built our muscles up with the weight. We were all in pretty good shape.
Okay.
Weaponry, we only had the basic M16, and we had some grenades that were issued to us. I did manage to get a Thompson 45 submachine gun, 45 caliber submachine gun.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that weapon. Jungle got that for me.
Mm-hmm.
Traded, I think it was 8 cases of sea rations for it. And I had that the whole 6 months I was up on the hill. And I finally did leave the hill. I left it there with one of the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a non-issue item. I couldn't take it back to Camp McDermott.
Right.
And it was a good weapon, though. It held a straight 30-round clip.
Mm-hmm.
And it would chuck pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
One story I got to tell you, though, is the day we went fishing.
Okay.
Jungle says, let's go fishing. I said, what do you mean fishing? Well, down in the valley, there was a river ran through there. So he went and got a case of outdated grenades. He went down to the river, and there was a cemetery there, right on the edge of the bank of the river. And the bee and Jungle, and it was 5 or 6 of his Korean buddies, drove down there in a Jeep and a truck. And I'm trying to figure out, what do you got in mind? Well, in Vietnam, they buried their dead, and they covered a gravesite with mounds. And the mounds were like 4 or 5 feet high. And along the edge of the river, there was a bunch of mounds. He says, come here, I'll show you how we fish. But the Koreans loved fish, and they were looking to get any food they could get, but they didn't get much food except rice and bacon and a thing called kimchi. It's a peppered cabbage. So we sat down with our backs to the mound, and he started lobbing grenades into the river. And, of course, they would go off, and the Koreans would run out there with their nets and scoop up the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would take them back to the hill and have a big fish fry. So they were ecstatic, you know. But the only time I ever went fishing was hand grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And it was different, and it was fun. And another time he took his honey and in the same area down there in the valley. And so we went hunting, and they had a type of bird over there, something like our pheasant. And we didn't have shotguns. We went hunting with our M16s. And, of course, we didn't hit anything. But we did flush up a lot of birds and have a lot of fun trying to shoot. So
okay.
Anything we could do for recreation and to break the boredom.
Yeah.
You know, Jungle had a lot of ideas. He kept us entertained.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Sunday activities earlier. I was curious if there were any church services that you could attend or you did attend.
No, we didn't. We didn't have them. We could have if we drove all the way back through the train and to the south end of town where Camp McDermott was, and you know they had church services on the main base camp there on Sunday.
Okay.
But none of the four of us were very religious. We just didn't go to church.
How about other security issues and other attacks? Were you guys ever, were you mortared or attacked much at West Nautrani?
Not at West Nautrani.
Okay. Right, we already. Right.
Like I say, we were pretty secure where we were. We
yeah.
were surrounded by the other Korean companies.
Yeah.
Just the isolated incident I explained.
Right.
Hit and run thing.
Right, with the sappers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because those guns did raise a lot of heck with them. And they were trying to get those guns.
Right. What about civic action.
What?
Civic action. You mentioned in the questionnaire that your unit supported an orphanage.
Yes.
Did you yourself get there very much? Did you do any kind of physical labor to build the orphanage, or what was that like?
No, the orphanage was already built and well established when the 459 signal battalion took over sponsorship of it. And over the years that the 459th was in country, they supported that orphanage in the train the whole time.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it was war orphans, and they did everything they could, you know, money-wise and the supplies, and make sure the kids were well-fed, well-clothed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was run by Vietnamese nuns. They were actually Catholic nuns.
Mm-hmm.
Who took care of the children. And I only got to go there twice. That's when I was stationed back at Camp McDermott. I was involved in two trips out there taking stuff out. And one time we had a party for kids. They were always doing something. The orphanage, the guys really chipped in on that orphanage. They were always welcome, you know, always eager to go out there and help the kids. So it was a good experience.
Okay. And you mentioned some of the other recreation. How about USO shows? Did you see any while you were in country?
No, I never did.
Okay.
I never got to Camp McDermott the 6 months I was there.
Mm-hmm.
They would have Vietnamese bands come in.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the USO shows were the one extreme, they'd be go out to the front lines,
mm-hmm.
where the Marines and the camps out in the boonies were, and or to the major cities like Saigon. They didn't hit bases like ours too much. They didn't come there too much.
Okay.
So I never did see an NCO show or a USO show.
Mm-hmm. Did you go on R&R?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I waited until I had about 3 months left in country. I went on R&R to Bangkok, Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
How was that?
It was 5 days of rest and relaxation. I had a good time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short flight from the train to Bangkok, Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
Bangkok, Thailand wasn't too far from. It was east of South Vietnam. The next country over was Thailand. And it was a major Asian city.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really impressed with how clean it was. Compared to the train, you know, it was beautiful. You couldn't find a cigarette butt in the streets over there. It's really clean. You know, and you couldn't find trash anywhere, even in the slums. You know, they were even decent. I don't know what it was about Bangkok. It was just a super clean city.
Mm-hmm.
They had crews working all the time cleaning up the street. I guess they wanted to make a good impression on the Americans.
Okay.
But, like I say, I got to Bangkok, and the custom there was your room was booked for you. You had to pay for it up front. They wanted to make sure they got their money. You didn't pay when you left. Most of the time when the GIs left, they didn't have any money left anyway. So that first order of business was pay for the room. And they had a special hotel set up just for the Americans. They were Thai hotels under contract to the U.S. U.S. government. And with names like I stayed at the Miami Hotel. They would have American names. So first order of business was pay your bill. My second order of business was get me a taxi driver. Taxi drivers were for hire, and they would be your sole taxi driver for the whole 5 days we're there.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a taxi driver. I forget his Thai name, his real name. He went by Joe. That was his English name. And he stayed with me, or was available to me. He didn't stay with me. He was available to only me for 5 days. And I forget what it cost, but some ridiculous low sum, $20 a day or something like that. And he would take you anywhere you wanted to go. Of course, he knew the city. He knew all the sites, he knew all the bars, he knew, you know, the city real well. So the first order of business was for me to get clean after I got my taxi driver. So I went to, I forget what they call it, it was a public bath where you would go in and hot water in a sunken tub and just get clean. And about an hour and a half in there, I was finally deemed myself clean enough. Got a lot of the red dust dirt out of my pores.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, on R&R, you just want to have fun. You want to eat good. You want to have some companionship. And of course, that was readily available also. And you want to see the sights.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of sights. I was really busy touring Vietnam. A lot of temples, or touring Thailand, Bangkok. I saw temples, I saw a 9-foot-tall sitting Buddha made out of solid gold. That was amazing. It was at a large temple there. They had found this Buddha back in the jungles in one of the old cities in Thailand. And the story behind it was covered in some kind of concrete or plaster. And they started chipping away at it, and underneath it was gold. They brought it to Bangkok, put it on display in a temple there. Of course, they had two or three guards with machine guns standing around it and it was fenced off. And it was one of the sights to see over there.
Mm-hmm.
So 5 days went real fast. Then I was down, I think, to 88 days left in country when I went back.
Mm-hmm.
And the night I got back to Camp McDermott was the night of the rocket attack.
Mm-hmm.
The night I came back from the hill, I think it was early August, was the night of the mortar attack.
Mm-hmm.
So when I came back from R&R, they said, Sergeant Moore, every time you come back from somewhere, we get hit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a bad luck charm, I guess. But it just was a coincidence. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I'm back from R&R. I've got 88 days left in country. And the story I sent you was the actual story of the mortar attack. That was the night I got back from
mm-hmm.
the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite an experience.
Well, why don't you go ahead and relate what you remember about that?
Oh, okay. I was asleep. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was dreaming about back home. And, I was dreaming about a parade in my hometown with a truck in the parade, a vehicle in the parade that backfired. And that's what woke me up. Trying to figure out what was that noise, and it was the retort of the mortars going off. And it woke me up, and the fellow was in the room with me. I remember his first name was Pete. He had he was just doing his last 3 days. He came back to process out. And there's not much you can do. Mortars are coming right in on your area. You just get down on the floor and cover yourself up. And we did, and I don't know, it was only a matter of a couple of minutes, and it stopped. And luckily, we weren't wounded or anything. There was a couple of guys seriously wounded that night that were out in the open and got hit by the shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
But I had never seen the effects of mortars. And, of course, when daylight came, I went out into the company area and looked around. I didn't see anything. Mortars, I found out later, go off the instant they touch something.
Mm-hmm.
And the shrapnel flies up and out. So
mm-hmm.
there was no craters or indentation anywhere.
Yeah.
And that was a little surprising. As loud as they were, I'm out there looking for big holes in the ground. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, of course, needless to say, that was an exciting night.
Yes, sir.
What else?
Well, anything else happen of that you recall of significance before you left? After your R&R?
I started spending a lot of time sleeping in the bunker outside in Camp McDermott the last 2.5 months I was there.
Okay.
Like I say, the barracks weren't. They were real flinty. Well, we had another rocket attack later on. It's not directly in the company area. It hit down near the commerce site.
Mm-hmm.
Wiped out a few buildings down there. It hit the chaplain's office. He took a direct hit. I was getting a short-timer's attitude. I'd get a little paranoid, so
mm-hmm.
I would take my sleeping bag out and into the bunker, and I'd be ready. I'd already be there, you know, if anything happened.
Right.
I got down to 5 days left in the country. And got a surprise at the morning formation. First sergeant said I was leaving today. I got a 5-day drop.
Wow.
So,
did that happen very often?
Yeah, guys would get drops. Some of the guys that were, some of the guys would volunteer to go to Vietnam. They had an early out release program.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them would get even 6 months off of their enlisted tour.
Mm-hmm.
They volunteered.
Okay.
And drops of 5-10 days were not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
So, as soon as the first sergeant said I was leaving that day, you had to get your affairs in order.
Mm-hmm.
This was 8 o'clock in the morning. By 10 o'clock, I had cleared the medical and finance, got my records, and I was ready to go. I threw about a third of a bag full of stuff into the duffel bag, and that's all I left with.
Okay.
Left everything else there.
Mm-hmm.
I got a short hop from the train to city there. It's a 10-minute flight back to Cameron Bay. That's where the big airport was. I got, so by 11 o'clock I was in Cameron Bay, and that's where they had a processing center there that you had to go through. It didn't take long. They headed down to the science.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many guys coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't take long to process through that and get my flight assignment. And at 5 o'clock that afternoon, I boarded a Boeing 707. 220 other guys. We were out of there.
Mm-hmm.
They called them the Freedom Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And
When was this?
This was in the end of October 69.
October 69.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, sir. Let me go ahead and pause this for a moment, please. This will end CD number one of the interview with Mr. William Moore. This is Steve Maxtron continuing the interview with Mr. William Moore on the 11th of January 2002 at approximately 10 minutes to 10 Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Moore is in Elkton, Maryland. This is CD number two of the interview. Sir, why don't we go ahead and continue discussing your trip home. What was the atmosphere like on the aircraft as you guys were leaving Vietnam?
Joyous. I imagine all the flights were like that. As soon as we left the ground, a big cheer and clapping and yelling, a sense of overall relief. It was quite an experience. Like I say, it was 225 GIs on there,
yes, sir.
All ranks,
mm-hmm.
all services. And the greatest majority of us were just happy to be
mm-hmm.
out of Vietnam. It,
right.
was, it was really nice. Of course, the guys were all excited to see some round-eyed women. The stewardesses were all very attractive. That was a change. And the flight was a long flight, but it didn't seem long coming back. Going over, it took forever. I think it was 13 hours to get back to the States. I can't remember the route we took. think it was the northern group doing the way we went. We ended up in Seattle, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And we bused to Fort Lewis, Washington, where we processed for our either out of the Army or for our leave. Mm-hmm. We were entitled to a 30-day leave. Got to Fort Lewis. It was the middle of the night. Of course, that was a 24-hour operation also, processing returnees. And the first thing they did was invited us into their mess hall for a meal. And it was an enlisted mess hall, but it was set up very nice. I remember tablecloths on the tables, nice silverware, and steak to order, steak dinner to order, which they brought to the table. You didn't have to go through a line. And we all enjoyed a meal while they were fixing up our Class A uniforms. They were, in the 2 hours that we were at the mess hall, they got our uniforms ready to wear with all the patches and insignias sewn on them and tailored to size. And, we went and got our uniforms and went back to the barracks they assigned us to and changed clothes. Well, got cleaned up, changed clothes, hot showers. While this was going on, they were processing our paperwork to get us flights, get us our plane tickets, commercial flights. So by mid-morning that day, we were ready to leave there. And, of course, all the guys went to the Four Winds, you know, wherever they were going in the States. Went to the Seattle airport, Seattle-Tacoma airport, and got a flight to terminate in Philadelphia. Flew to San Francisco first, changed planes there. At San Francisco airport, well, my mom knew I was coming home somewhere around early that next week. I didn't have a chance to let her know that I got a 5-day drop. So as soon as I got to the airport in San Francisco, I called her. Of course, she was ecstatic. She was really relieved that I was home.
Yes, sir.
And I said, well, I'll be home soon. And so I got on a plane in San Francisco, flew to Chicago, stop there shortly. I don't know if I changed planes or refueled or something, and then went into Pittsburgh and into Philadelphia. So, in a matter of a day and a half, I was out of Vietnam and back in civilian life, or in fact, you know, I was still in the Army, but back in the United States on a 30-day leave.
Mm-hmm. Did you encounter any kind of hostility during that trip to your to home?
No. At all. I was in uniform. Nobody really came up and talked to me or, you know, welcome home or anything like that, but nobody bothered me.
Okay.
Sort of, people at the airport were either busy or indifferent or what. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have any problems adjusting from such a, you know, during a rapid transition like that, in country one day and at home a day
later?
No,
I'm lucky. I must have a kind of temperament, laid back or easy. I had no problems at all. I did have a sense of relief of being out of there, but like I say, I was still in the Army. I still had time to go.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to enjoy my leave and. In fact, I didn't even have an assignment yet. I didn't get my assignment. So sometime in that 30-day leave, they sent me some order.
Okay.
They assigned me to Fort Bliss, Texas.
Texas, yeah.
Yeah.
How much time did you have left in service?
Oh, let me see. I re-enlisted. I had about a year.
Okay.
I got to Fort Bliss. Yeah.
Now, I forgot to ask you, during the bulk of your time at West Nha Trang,
yeah,
there was, of course, major battle over near in the Pleiku area for Hamburger Hill. And I didn't know if your station received a significant amount of traffic during that battle and in the days that followed. And if you noticed...
Do you know what month that was?
Yeah, that was May of 69.
No, all our circuits were Korean circuits.
Okay.
And,
so you guys...
I didn't even know about Hamburger Hill until I saw the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just out of curiosity, did you notice any change in attitude or any change in the atmosphere in the last few three or four months that you were in country? Did you receive any orders or... Was there anything, did you notice any difference, say, in the last 3 months compared to your first 3 months?
The overall attitude of...
Of American forces and of the American commanders?
No. Like I say, I was with the 459th, and our particular mission was just to keep those circuits open.
Right. Okay.
We didn't get much information on what was going on in the big picture.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, what was the, how, were you at all surprised at the atmosphere in the United States when you came back?
Oh, yes. Oh,
what surprised you most?
Oh. well, in late 69, there was all kinds of things going on. The war protest was at its peak. College campuses, the young people were... almost up in arms, you know. The general feeling of the American public, when I found out after I got back to the States, is get those guys out of there, you know. And I'm convinced to this day that if we didn't get out of there, we'd still be there because the enemy was not going to give up. They were just going to, however long it took, you know, they were going to be there. So it was wise for us to get out of there. Of course, the process they went through to get us out of there was long and protracted. The peace accords, the peace talks with Paris, it just took forever. They could have withdrew much earlier, but I don't know, to save space or whatever, they went through these talks. Finally did get everybody out of there. It took too long. The average Joe could see that we were fighting a losing cause there.
Well, when you were back in the States, you spent your last year in the Army at Fort Bliss from like November of 69
to
November 7?
I re-enlisted at Fort Bliss.
Okay, you re-enlisted.
Yeah,
okay.
I re-enlisted for 6 years.
Okay. Well, what was the atmosphere like in the military, and where you were stationed in, say, 1973, when the Paris Peace Accords were signed?
The military in 73, just before and after the peace accord was signed, we became a peacetime army. And I think the draft stopped about that time.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And the McNamara came up with this idea, I think it was him, of, they call it McNamara's 100,000 was the program, to fill the slots. They were accepting just about anybody. They were recruiting just about anybody they could get to, you know, fill the slots and keep the Army up to strength.
Mm-hmm.
And from 73 to 77, when I got out, the standards were lowered and the Army got a lot of unmotivated, uneducated people.
Uh-huh.
It didn't want to work. Discipline took a nosedive. A lot of the officers wouldn't back up their NCOs because they were just worried about their careers, either extending their careers or they were getting short and were going to get out anyway.
Overall, the military really took a nosedive in 73 and 77 as far as discipline and morale. And, the war was over. Everybody looked at it as a defeat. First war we ever lost, you know, stuff like that.
Where were you in 1973?
In 73, I was at, let's see, I left Bliss, went to Korea, came back. I was at Fort Hood, Texas.
Okay.
For 2 years, which was the worst 2 years I spent in the Army.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Fort Hood, Texas is out in the middle of cow country in Texas. And it's like an isolated base. There's not much around for entertainment. Or you had to either go to San Antonio or Houston or Dallas, Fort Worth, to actually see some civilization. We were... I was with a signal company there. Spent about half the time on field exercises. I do remember one occasion, they sent us out to LBJ's ranch as backup communications of some kind, in case the telephone lines went down. They were having some big summit or meeting there. We spent 3 or 4 days in a cow pasture out there on standby for communications. They never did need us, though. And I got from when I was at Fort Hood, I finally got ordered to Germany and spent my last 3 years in Germany, and I enjoyed that tour because I was getting short then. I knew I had decided at my 8-year mark to get out when this enlistment was over.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over there with 3 years left. I had a reconciliation with my wife, brought her and the son over. Two of those last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I ETS the Army from Germany.
Okay.
Went back to Spain. Like.
Now, was there much change? You mentioned that there were significant problems in the Army when you came back in terms of discipline. You didn't mention drug use. Was that also a problem?
Drug use was in Germany and Fort Hood in that period of time was pretty high. It was rampant.
Okay. So it was the same in Germany as it was in the United States?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, especially among the enlisted lower ranks. Drugs were readily available. You could go into a German drugstore and buy drugs. You could buy over-the-counter. It was illegal for the American GI to do it, but stuff was available right in the stores.
What kind of drugs do you mean?
Uppers, downers. They had liquid stuff that the guys would pour in their cokes. The upper, guys were buzzing all the time. One particular occasion, we had a IG inspection coming up. I was in charge of one floor of the barracks. I was a E6 by this time.
Mm-hmm.
And my platoon, I was a squad leader. My platoon, a lot of the young guys, to get ready for the inspection, they would take this liquid speed, I called it, and we would just fire them up. They could go for hours and hours working, with a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this place looking spotless. I mean, you couldn't find a trace of dirt anywhere on that whole floor, in the bathroom, the washroom, the rooms. And, they were eager to pass the inspection, but they really went overboard. I mean, they came up with all kinds of ideas. They had a team that would lay out everybody's field display, and they were all exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
They had another team cleaning the showers and the washers and dryers where the place was gleaming,
Mm-hmm.
Climbing the walls, scrubbing it, and shining the pipes. We got one gig. We got a 99%. The only gig we got was in the dryer. The lint filter was made out of a fine mesh wire and with a hole in it. And the inspecting officer pulled out the lint dryer and saw the hole, and that was the gig. That's the only gig we got. Couldn't find anything else anywhere. The floors were so shiny you could see your face in. Of course, we found out, we knew that the
Oh, for crying out loud.
That was the only gig we got. And we got a day off. The whole platoon got a day off for scoring highest on the IG inspection of the year.
So they got high.
They got a reward for it.
cleaned the barracks really well and got a reward for it.
Yeah. And it was the same order. The IG inspection is a complete battalion inspection, motor pool, everything, records.
Right.
You know, we did real well.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because, even though there was drug use, there also seemed to be...
some benefit.
Well, I mean, but not so much the benefit, but motivation to perform well. And, in order to do that, some discipline.
Yeah, well, the guys more or less took it on their own. You didn't have to prod them or push them. That particular inspection, they just wanted to do well, I guess. They were motivated, self-motivated. But the rest of the time was either out in the field, field exercises, or we were on what was called a concern, a closed concern.
Yes.
And we had a big motor pool, of course, for all our trucks and everything. It would be the pulling motor stables. Your daily training consisted of exercise in the morning, pulling motor stables, and then just maintenance. And you'd go out online, fire up your rig, fire up the generator, put a dummy load on it, test things, you know, stuff like that. And just the same thing every day, except when you were out in the field or exercising. And that was a lot of going to a site, you know, setting up, tearing down, jumping in the middle of the night, moving. And every October, they had the big reforger exercise in Germany. We were out there for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
A massive countrywide field exercise.
Mm-hmm.
We were on call to go down to what was called the Fulda Gap. That was our area.
Mm-hmm.
The Fulda Gap was the point where the Russians came over. That's where they thought they would come over.
Right.
And we had 13 divisions in Germany, and they had 39. So the American force was there during the Cold War to delay the advance long enough to get support over there. That was our mission, to pull the gap.
Now, while you were there, did you have any special training, or the entire time you were in the Army, did you receive training on dealing with equipment that had been damaged due to electromagnetic pulse, the result of an atomic detonation or nuclear detonation?
No, just in the class, they covered that at various schools I went to. I was when I wasn't in Vietnam, my other 9 years in the Army, I was more or less a professional student.
Okay.
I would sign up for any class they were given because... in my MOS, they had a cutoff score that was so high they'd get promoted from E5 to E6. It was almost unreachable.
Mm.
Slots weren't available for almost 5 years.
Mm.
So I did everything I could to build up my points. Because I wanted to make E6. You know?
Yeah.
And I went to two NCO academies. I went to CBR school. I went to generator school. Always did well in the courses, so they looked at my record and they would send me. You know, they'd give me a slot to the school. And I finally got as high as I could at points, and I still didn't have enough. So my next to last year in Germany, they dropped the cutoff score 50 points. Perfect was 1,000. They dropped it to 851, and I had 855, and I finally got promoted to E6. Some E6 slots came available.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to all kinds of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, getting all that education, like I went to CBR school about midway through my 10 years. They saw that on my record. Every unit I went to as an additional duty, I would be the CBR NCO.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping track of all the radiation monitoring equipment and the gas mask, keeping everything calibrated up to date.
Mm-hmm.
So, extra duties.
Well, you were in Germany in 1975 then, correct?
Yeah.
Do you remember the atmosphere in your unit when Saigon fell in April of 75?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of Vietnam veterans there. And, it was kind of a low point for everybody.
Yeah.
Because officially we had lost the war.
Yeah.
You know. And the big thing then was, well, now, too, we had never lost a major war that we engaged in. And, yeah, it was kind of a low point for a lot of guys.
Yeah.
But life was on, you know.
Yes, sir.
In my case, you know, life went on. Overly worried.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you know any guys over there? Either, well, not just in Germany, but also here in the U.S. When you were still active duty, did you meet any guys that were having a hard time coping with their Vietnam experiences that were still on active duty?
No, I didn't run into that until years later. I joined the Vietnam Veterans of America.
Mm-hmm.
And had occasion to work with our vet center here in town and Burryville. VA hospital was right down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And when the contingent from our chapter would go to visit guys or have a party for them at the hospital, and then I actually saw how messed up a lot of the guys were.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the psycho ward down in the psychological ward down in Furryville was not a nice place to visit. We went down there. There's still guys in here to this day. They just couldn't get over it.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to do anything we can here locally to ease the burden a little bit for the guys.
Yep.
In fact, just this Christmas we went down to the rehab ward, rehabilitation ward, and had a party and took gifts. A lot of guys, most guys were really glad to see us because it's really boring in there. Same thing every day.
Mm-hmm.
Anything out of the ordinary, like a party or somebody bringing gifts, or even just going in and visiting, they really like to enjoy that. The ward we did this year was the rehab ward, and where guys had strokes or had operations, on-demand therapy and so forth. Eventually, those fellows will be out of there and go back to their homes. A lot of the guys on the floor above in the psychological ward, some of them will never get out of there. So we try to do what we can for them.
Right. Let's see. When you came back to the United States initially, in your questionnaire you indicated that a friend of the family took you down to the VFW post, and the local VFW post, I guess, near where you live.
Right, in the town of Fallcroft, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
He was an older man. He was a real good friend of my mother's side of the family for years. I forget how they got together, but he was like a surrogate grandfather to us.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we called him Papa when we were kids. You know, it was just my mother and me and my brother. And it was a father figure household. And, he was sort of like a father and a grandfather, too. And he had been in the Second World War, and he was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary. He was too old to go into the service. Volunteered for the Coast Guard Auxiliary patrolling the East Coast here. They had some kind of, it wasn't even a military group, it was some kind of civilian group attached to the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And it qualified him to join the VFW after the war. He's been a member ever since, all the way up through when he took me over there. 69.
Mm-hmm.
So
when you first joined, Was there any kind of resistance, or how were you treated by the other VFW members?
Well, I remember going there with him and sitting at the bar, and he asked the bar person for an application. And of course, he bought the first round of drinks. And, we filled out the application, and he paid for it and gave it back to the person. And it was processed there. But nobody in the bar at the time came up and talked to us or anything. It was mostly World War II vets. And even to this day, I feel I belong. I'm a life member of the VFW here in the Northeast. Even to this day, it's getting a little better, but I still feel uncomfortable going to a VFW.
Why is that?
Well, the general consensus of World War II vets is that Vietnam wasn't really a war. World War II was the war. I can't give you a percentage, but the majority of the World War II vets at that time didn't really consider us veterans of foreign wars and didn't welcome us openly to their clubs. I've seen that over the years. I've talked to other Vietnam veterans throughout the country when I go to conventions and stuff. It was all over the United States. We weren't really welcomed with open arms at the VFW. American Legion, on the other hand, was a little different. I belong to that, too. We were more welcome there than the VFW. And now the attitude has changed for some of the World War II vets. I'd say the change occurred in the mid to late 80s after the Vietnam Memorial Wall was dedicated. And the VFW, the World War II guys, looked into it a little more. And some of them realized, yeah, it was a war. These guys put their life on the line just like we did. And the attitude changed a little bit. But some of the hardcore guys to this day are still the same. They'll never change their attitude.
Right. Okay. Well, what are your personal feelings about your service in Southeast Asia?
I went over there with the thought of preserving democracy. got caught up in the Kennedy thing. What can you do for your country? Let's stop the spread of communism and so forth. I went over there with the attitude of doing my duty, and I did the year over there, and really relieved to get out of there. I saw the in-country big picture, and then when I got back to the States, saw all the protesting going on. So I was really out of touch with that year, kind of isolated. Got the Army Times newspaper once in a while, and radio broadcast. We didn't really know what was going on back in the States where we were. And when I got back to the States and saw the overall attitude of the populace getting out of there, attitude changed a little bit. So, but like I say, at the time, I went over there to do my thing for the country. Luckily, managed to get through it.
Yes, sir. Well, do you think that our goals were justified?
Yes, I do.
By the costs?
Yeah, the goal was, I perceived, to stop the advance of communism. We didn't want Southeast Asia falling into communist hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then the alleged domino effects of, from there into Malaysia and maybe into the Philippines and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
The basic idea was okay for me. You know, let's stop the spread of communism before it blossoms. Now, Cuba that's another, that's a whole other subject. I don't know what the heck they, why the heck they didn't bounce them out of Cuba long ago. That's another whole story. I don't know what the heck was going on down there for the last 30 years.
Well, what do you think about U.S. normalizing relations with Vietnam?
Well, our DVA national president went to Vietnam on a trip with Clinton. And boy, I'll tell you what, the majority of the members didn't go for that at all. They lost a lot of respect for him, even though in his 6 years in office, he did an awful lot of good for the DVA. He really stepped on his own toes. Went over there with the Clinton party.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton went over there. Most of the BVA members aren't for normalizing relations with Vietnam.
Okay.
And I'm not either. Let's not sink any more money into that country than we already have. They can get on by themselves.
Okay.
They don't really need us. That's the way I feel.
Okay. Well, what are the most important things you took away from your Vietnam War experience personally?
The main thing is more of a respect for life. We're all human beings. And some of the things I saw and heard about over there, war is not the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing, I got more of a respect for life and more of a thankfulness that, my life is continuing and has over the years. I really have more of a respect for life as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I learned was nothing's ever as bad as it seems. A lot of bad things can happen, but there's always a way out. You can get over it.
Right.
So bad you can't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main two things.
What do you think we should take away from the experience as a nation, collectively?
Main thing is don't get into a guerrilla war. Proved over there that you're fighting a losing battle, and it was proven to the Russians in Afghanistan. Same thing. They were in there 10 years. You're not going to beat a determined guerrilla force in their own country, no matter what, no matter how many bombs you drop on them. Bombing them is not the answer. You can bomb all you want. The spirit of the the civilian force is just not going to give in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the main thing I learned.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to discuss today?
No. About it for me. I just wanted to ask you a few questions.
Okay, let me go ahead and put an end to this interview
Sure.
Real quick. This will end the interview with Mr. William Moore. Thank you very much, sir.